ladies and gentlemen. While they're trying to sort out the challenge that we have with the IT, with this laptop here, which is very vital for presentation, I think I would do my present duty of a very good morning to all of you and welcoming you to day two of this setup. I have the present responsibility to briefly recap the activities of yesterday and to take you through the process for today. This commission is being chaired by the Honourable Sufi Limbeku, my colleague in the portfolio committee. My name is Dr. Shah, I'm also a member of the committee. We have my colleague, the Honourable Stuart Farrell, also present. There's parallel commission, two other commissions that are underway. One is in room G41, which is being chaired by the Honourable Korai, and another one in room G42, which is being chaired by the Honourable Khalifa Makassi. Let's hope by the end of this introduction, the IT problem would have been resolved for presentation. Well, yesterday, you would agree with me, it was a long day, but it was a very fruitful day. I hope today will be as fruitful as well. We began the day by opening and welcoming remarks by the Honourable Gomeda, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. He briefed us about the context of the summit and the subject and the theme, which is removing barriers for tourism growth to fulfill the national development plan. He focused on the need for an effective and efficient LFT strategy in order to promote development and growth of the tourism sector, and I'm not going to say much about that. Jefferson will elaborate on that input because it is quite relevant to this commission. It was followed by the keynote address by the Honourable Minister of Tourism. In his introduction, he covered four broad themes: the issue of partnerships, tourism as a driver of economic development in South Africa, and some of our plans in respect of international and domestic tourism, including our response to shifts in the global marketplace. And he also spoke about travel facilitation and air connectivity. Then we had a very significant input on the importance of intergovernmental relations by the Ambassador, Adam Mahubela, Director General for the Department of Tourism. He focused on five themes, namely policy and legislative mandates of the respective spheres of government, other frameworks and strategies, tourism, intergovernmental structures, initiatives to support alignment and coordination, domestic tourism, and critical success factors. We also had input from Dr. Sisu Kuzwayo, who is our Special Advisor to the Portfolio Committee. He spoke about the contextualization based on legislative and oversight function of the Portfolio Committee. He spoke about the role that we play as a Portfolio Committee and our oversight function of the department. We then had an input from the national concerning the National Development Plan and its implications for tourism. The presenter was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ismail Saladin. And his presentation was very interesting. It was based on six pillars of the NDP, namely mobilization of all South Africans, active engagement of citizens in their own development, expansion of the economy, and making growth inclusive, building on key capabilities such as human, physical, and institutional. He spoke about building a capable and developmental state, and the sixth pillar he spoke about was fostering a strong leadership throughout society. We then had a break and followed by a presentation by Mr. Sibusiso Kava, the DG for Arts and Culture, and some of the observations he made were around the role of arts and culture in the tourism sector and by extension in the economy of the country, and he made a very powerful statement, and I quote, art and culture play the role of gold, the role that gold plays in the historical economy of our country. He spoke about cultural events as a driver of economic growth, made some suggestions about the film industry being used as a tool, and he also suggested that there ought to be a heritage levy, which many people were not very interested, you know, not enthusiastic about. We then had session two. We had a presentation by Mr. Captain Nakoda, who is the Director of Planning and Coordination. He spoke about TICC and his role in the technical task team. And his team was aligning the tourism industry to the presidential infrastructure plan. In his input, he spoke about the aligning of the tourism industry to the PICC, and the framework he used were the SIPs, which is the strategic integrated projects that has been developed and adopted by the cabinet. He outlined them respectively. He spoke about the five geographic SIPs. I'm not going to go into the details. We also had a very interesting input from Mr. Busi Madantena, from the who's the leader of corporate governance, spoke about the significance of local government in tourism development. And that was a very important input because, you know, local government is the level at which delivery takes place, and we had all of us identified the critical challenges and gaps, especially the issue of capacity at that level to deliver a tourism mandate. I now would like to just highlight some of the issues that were deliberated, that emanated from yesterday's session. And they are as follows, and I'm not going to go into detail. That there was a need to invest in both mature and emerging markets. There were that more resources needed to be spent on domestic tourism, and for this to happen or succeed, needs a strong partnership between public and private sector. And I think the following contribution came from myself, that the South African tourism, anti-tourism, should think about ranking tourism growth on domestic tourism as compared to international tourism. And I think that point was perhaps misunderstood. So perhaps somebody thought that I was saying we should forget about international tourism. That's not what I was saying. I was focusing on the importance of having a parallel initiative, because global factors sometimes affect international arrivals, and that domestic tourism should be our anchor, and that should develop infrastructure in a manner that will serve international arrivals if and when the global economic situation improves. We also discussed some matters regarding the NDP, that we need to understand roles of different stakeholders and create more synergies to eliminate inefficiencies. I think the role of stakeholders, that is all of you, but we are all stakeholders, is very, very significant. I think it came across that we are, it is significant for the growth and development of the tourism industry. It's like an engine, you see, like a motor car engine, made of various components. If one component is defective, then it affects the efficiency and the working of the motor vehicle. So all stakeholders, that's why we're having this summit, because we want to listen to you. We also have the following observations, that we have different charging regimes for citizen and international tourists visiting culture and heritage tourism attractions, that we need to do so to cater for the need of the lesser, you know, privileged, of those who cannot afford benefiting from our tourism attractions. So the proposal of joint marketing of tourism and cultural offerings, the potential of the SIPs for tourism development was discussed. It was said that it needs to be reported on within the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, and information of these outcomes should be related to tourism, to tourism stakeholders. When we talk about the joint planning is needed in national strategy and policy development between Department of Tourism and Culture and Cooperative Governance. That Cooperative Governance calls for piloting and implementing the beyond the strategies to municipalities to discharge the tourism function, and municipalities need guidelines and information on funding avenues. We raise the issue of LE, guidance and establishing tourism structures targeting LED officials at municipal level is required from the NDT. Assistance in developing tourism sector strategies at local what happens to be a critical issue to stimulate tourism development. The issue of the tourism planning toolkit was raised, the joint implementation of the tourism planning toolkit for local government between National Department of Tourism and Corporate of Government must be pursued. And there were so many other matters that were raised, it's just too long to be discussed here in the introduction. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I just want to perhaps tell you about the activities of the day, the rest of the activities. The Commission will be reviewing presentations and having discussions around the issues that will be raised here or that were raised yesterday. We will then raise a present recommendation for adoption as a resolution after discussions. The delegates that are involved with the other two commissions will return to the main hall here and report back from their respective commissions. And then we will be tabling resolutions for adoption. And the summit will then be closed by the Deputy Minister. Hopefully she should be here by then. Without further ado, I now hand over to the Honourable Cecilia Mbengue, who is going to chair the commission, and I thank you.
Good morning. It's a nice day to thank you. It's that time that takes us back in time. Remember where we come from to be who we are, not what we are. I don't think it's because what we have achieved since 1994 defeats all other minds that thought we'll be where we are today. I'm saying this because we are still engaged in the transformation of our country. 1994 was not the end, it was the beginning. And a lot of people thought that, and they still think that it was the end. The Honourable Member spoke about our National Development Plan, which all of us, all South Africans, agree that it is our plan that is going to take us forward. Not for us, but for our children. Because I'm not thinking about 20, 30, and I was thinking about my age and say, how old will I be? In 2019, and what will I be leaving behind for our children? The challenge is great. The challenge is so great because I was thinking that, by the way, we are not science who always expect a kill to find something to eat. We will never expect a lion to kill a buffalo so that a hyena must find something to eat. We are the lions. The competition outside there is looking at us with greed and opportunities that we as South Africans were opening up for our region, for our continent, and also to benefit the international community. Cause others not to feel good about it. You know the issue of economic downstream threatens almost everybody. The developed countries, they feel very much uncomfortable. Our relation, or when we talk about the issue of BRICS, we are creating one world, but you find that there is this uneasiness why is Arjuna doing that? Well, coming from 1994 and our constitution that spoke about reconciliation and nation building. If we were to go back and leave that, because most of us, we find ourselves not living what we fought for. South Africa is not viewed about what it is. It's about who that matters. Who are we? It's not centered on the material gain. It's centered about the wisdom South Africans have, all of us jointly and separately. This is not a podcast speech. We are about here about the end. Yesterday, much has been said. The trustworthiness of good end is a key driver of tourism in any tourism destination. That was quite clear, that was said yesterday. This must complement the effortlessness and ease of travel by tourists to any destination, internal and external. Amongst others is the careful route planning, customs and rules, affordability and frequency. Improved air leisure contributes to tourism growth and sustainable job creation in the long term. As we said, and we spoke about it, and the Honorable Chair spoke about it, the National Development Plan, it talks directly to the National Development. The question that one may ask is whether our resurgence, as we spoke yesterday, has the right answer. Having said that, it is imperative that good and sustainable working relations established between our country as a destination and airlines that service both international and domestic markets. So the question is, how? How are we going to do that? To achieve this goal, it must good collaboration among us as role players. I'm saying us, including us as members of parliament, as role players. Because there's a tendency of, when we are seated like this, there's a question of them and us. Not in the situation because we want, at the end of this commission, come to the resolution that abides. You mandate us to present that before Parliament as not a working plan, but a policy that the country must follow. Now, if then we are talking about that kind of a collaboration, how are we going to do it and how are we going to achieve it? So we have the international agreements such as the Yanasuk Declaration that has an impact on the growth of tourism arrivals in the region. I had a time to look into the declaration. I read through the declaration and I said, wow. we have to engage vehemently without any fear. I think the DG was saying this yesterday. Without any favor, without begging anybody about our rights regarding it. The issue of the long haul, we spoke much about it yesterday. Sadar is regarded as a long haul destination. Issues raised yesterday pose a challenge. To then say, how are we going to integrate with other countries, our region? The minister did bring up an issue about South and how to strengthen our region. We also spoke yesterday about the so-called emissions. these emissions tend to be seen to, in one way, penalize us and saving others, penalizing others, probably saving us, I'm not sure, but this commission must look into that particular one. Having said that, and coming to the week before, we have to understand the early strategy for the country. The education of the must also relate to the tourism industry. What needs to be done to unlock regional and international activities? The role of low-cost airlines in promoting domestic tourism and tourism climate interaction. I know that we have mines that have been dealing with these issues for a lengthy period. I do believe that at the end of the commission, and when we report to the plenary, we'll be coming up with declarations that are going to take us forward to influence our region, to influence our continent, and also impacting politics to our international community. Having said that, I would request my honorable member to come and be seated next to me. Honorable Chair. Or do you want us to come and sit there so that we can see the presentation? I think we'll do it. Right. But what I'm saying now, I think it's the time for us to study about mind, but it's the process. I know pretty well that there are those that will be wanting to be the first. I think it's the presenter who's presented. No, I accept that. What I've been saying is that according to the program, are we supposed to call upon people who are supposed to present at that forum asking them who is the first to stand? Excuse me. Thank you. Then followed by? Right. Without saying much, I think I'll be handing over to you, and then when that comes, I don't have the document before me, or there are other programs so that I can call people by their right full name, so I don't have to say you and you and you. Over to you, sir. And the time now. Wait. Before we start, I think there's something that must be done by Parliament, wherever they are. I've just noticed that all the talks, all the world talks, are not working. You go to the National Assembly, the good old thing is not working. So something must be done about that one. And Parliament must begin to deal with it accordingly. Let me turn that over to you, gentlemen.
Very honorable Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, that are present. Members of MEC of provinces, officials from national government and provinces, colleagues within the Tourism Social Fraternity. My name is Akele Twal. I work for the Department of Transport. I'm going to speak to the early strategy. The early strategy that has been in existence from 2006 to 2011. And also to indicate that there's a draft early strategy that will go to cabinet by end of this financial year. I'm going to speak to you on secret declarations in terms of what does it bring. And then I look at the status quo of both ELIST and Yamasuko declaration in terms of what the strategy wants to achieve, the ELIST strategy. And say a few words on challenges and make a statement. As you would know that it was necessary for South Africa at a given time to know where it is going, what it wants to achieve in relation to connectivity. And hence, the early strategy, which was aimed at the regulation of air transport in support of tourism growth strategy. It enabled connectivity for both passengers and cargo, and it afforded seamless travel throughout the world, and also enhances competitive advantage to South African operators. In keeping with the above, the mission of the air transport in particular with respect to tourism growth strategy is to ensure an enabling environment which responds effectively to the needs of domestic and international users of air services and air services providers. Now, within the realm of early strategy, the basic function is to promote, as indicated, connectivity. So how would that happen? Is that two countries would agree on a number of frequencies between the two countries. That's countries international. And the allocation of those to specific airline or individual airlines of those countries. In some instances, the countries, there's one such a country, Mozambique, that opted for seats. So instead of frequencies per week itself, you'll have 400 seats South Africa, 400 seats Mozambique. And with no designation, it means any other player, as long as those seats are available, you can take. So basically what happens there, an agreement then is signed between the two countries, that this is how connectivity is going to be promoted between the two countries. Improved relationship and partnership between state and stakeholders in the then government, moving towards shaping the air transport system as well as expanding the low-cost carrier concept. You would realize that of late there has been an advent of low-cost carriers. The first one in South Africa you would know was Phoenix Air, which was selling tickets in UQ, first come, first serve. If they have got their number, they close the door, they fly. Unfortunately, it could not live long in our industry in demand. And subsequently, there's been a number of them that have come. So one of the things, a challenge is, what are the problems with low-cost carriers in the country? Recently, Delta Sky and One Time also suffered the same fate, as you know. And we've got three operators waiting in the wings who want to enter into this market. The other issue that comes up is part of the Yamasuk Declaration is the increase of his freedom trust grants, which could be regarded as some, as a person to some, as a problem. Because according to the definition, is that a state can come to another state, establish an operation in that country, take passengers from one place to the other. The early strategy that was in operation between the last 5 years, it did have a technical approach to feed freedom. Where possible, if the 1, 2, 3, 4 freedoms, where a country can bring passengers from South Africa to one of our hubs and take passengers out, if that exists, and then we would tend towards not granting the feed freedom. But in terms of the Yamasuku Declaration, which was part of South Africa, we need to give freedom and also to pick up freedom. And in the process, there was then establishment and strengthening of regional aviation activity within SADC. And of major concern is the noting of frequencies. If I may just explain, as indicated in the bilateral agreement, you'd agree that you'd have 25 frequencies between the two countries. It means 28 for South Africa, 28 for the other countries. And you'll find that in most instances, very few, or on very few occasions, you find a situation where all the 28 frequencies are taken. And currently we're running at 35 noted frequencies. It means 35% of the agreed bilaterals in terms of the early strategy have not been taken. And then the Yamazuku Declaration. As you know, the concept came in after the United States introduced the liberalization of their skies. And there was therefore a reaction from all regions of IKO, where in our region, there was the Yamazuku Declaration. Leaders of our nation met in 1998 and cast what they called Yamazuku Declaration. And this Yamazuku is a town in Ivory Coast, so it's named after that town. And in that declaration, they declared that they opened skies within the African continent to promote aviation activity, safety, and tourism. The main objective of the YT basically will be gradual liberalization of scheduled and non-scheduled inter-African airspace, abolishing limits on capacity, frequency of international airspaces within Africa, liberalizing the airfares, and universally granting rights up to free freedom. So basically, we're saying among ourselves, we need not say you can only fly 4 times to my country if it's an African carrier within the African continent. You should open it up so that we can promote the connectivity. And the scope, for instance, it took in the issue of tariffs. It was then expressing itself in terms of what tariff regime would exist. And fortunately, the agreement in terms of the decision is that the agreement will be determined by carriers and the market has existed. The capacity and frequency, the capacity will determine whether the country is able to mount an air service within that country. The frequency is unlimited. As long as you are able to operate, you go ahead. And also it addresses the question of eligibility, which airlines will be eligible. Important in this is the question of a country that will be based in the African continent, operating in the African continent. And it means that country should be duly licensed by a state party, as defined in Annexure 6 of Chicago Convention. These are among many of the principles of the Yamazuku Declaration and decision. And what has happened since 2008? In terms of YT, these are the following countries, a few countries here including Botswana, that have signed the Yamazuku Declaration with South Africa. It means these countries are saying, if you want to fly 10 times to our country, you're free to do so. If you want to fly from one airport to the other in our country, you can continue doing it as well. Obviously, there are certain legal limitations like safety and other compliance issues that you need to meet. So it's Senegal, Kenya, Cameroon, Botswana. We have also Burkina Faso and Burundi. Indicated area in all is Mali. Now if you look at these markets, Nigeria is not part of it. Angola is not. Mozambique is not. And these are the three lucrative markets that you find in the continent, where everyone wants to fly close. And within the bilateral relations, we find that there are so many meeting clauses in that bilateral. Such that, for instance, one of the bilateral we had in Nigeria was that at that time, we had 6 frequencies with them. With 6 frequencies, the agreement that the South Africa has 6, they can have 6. But there's a clause that if they are able to have an operator, you can't include the additional frequency. So it means there's 4 between the 2 countries. There's 4 flying by Nigerian carriers, 4 flying by South African carriers. If you want to introduce the 5th, because you can introduce up to the 6th, they will say if they can't match up, then you can't introduce that. So we must wait for them to get an operator who comes into the market for us to be able to come to the market. So some of the other bilaterals are limited. And also the Yamazuku Declaration is in countries where it is not viable for operators to be flying from South Africa to those countries. For instance, if you take Burkina Faso, their proposal is that they should be half in West Africa. Then you've got Ghana, you've got Lagos, you've got Senegal, which there's more frequencies in those countries. So it doesn't become attractive for anyone to operate in those countries. Those are the countries that we have the Yamasuku Declaration. One of the reasons that we just started operating in South Africa end of 2010. And I raise that comes in with the Yamasuku Declaration because of its link with the political relations with Ethiopia, which has certain frequencies with South Africa. And therefore, South Africa doesn't even fly there or even operate, but it's got a code share to it. So Yamasuku, as much as it wants to deliver on certain things, but the way it is handled and manipulated, it is not possible to get the best out of Yamasuku as it was intended in 1998 to 1999. Here, as Nick mentioned earlier, we have the seat arrangement with the Mozambicans. And very difficult to negotiate with. We have been on this issue of seats for a very long time, trying to increase the connectivity between the two countries. Mali has Yamasuku, DRC has got 9. An attractive market, a developing market with 9 frequencies. Nigeria currently is at 13. Tanzania is 28, and Seychelles has the Yamasuku Declaration. So you can fly as many times as possible to Seychelles. By the time in Tanzania, you are limited to be only 28. Seychelles above, the following patterns can be extrapolated. We have very poor connectivity in the continent. I think it is known if you want to fly to Tunisia, you are better off to fly to France and back to Tunis rather than fly maybe to Egypt to Tunis because there's no direct flight to Tunisia. The same thing with Libya. So the connectivity is very poor in the continent. Where the connectivity and the market, it is limited. Limited by what? By the bilateral agreement. And this results in reduced competitiveness and quality of services on the inter-African route. In some instances, we are forced to fly that one carrier that uses that route. And we've got no choice. And therefore, it's a matter of take it or leave it. If they put a tariff or a price tag, you take it or else you don't fly to it. And this also leads to high cost of the travel. While this is happening, there's very significant impact to socio-economic development of the majority of African populations because of lack of economic activity between South Africa and those countries, and therefore the economic growth is stifled. The other challenge that we have is differences in microeconomic policies and strategies. Maybe sooner or later there's been issues in the media about a squabble between South Africa and Tanzania. The bilateral year in Tanzania had a clause which is in line with the Yamasuku Declaration, which says that all operators should be domiciled and operating from the country. So you have a situation where Tanzanians have told us that this particular operator is Tanzania, but that operator is from England, it operates from Britain. And it brings all sorts of problems. And if South Africa allows, becomes the first country ever to allow a foreign operator to operate in, into a floodgate. No one will be able to stop ever from establishing such a relationship. Because for them to go to Tanzania, establish themselves, and then they can fly to South Africa. When they enter South Africa's country, then they can compete with our domestic carrier, which is a huge risk to us. And we do not think we will be stifling development if we take such positions. According to Yamasuku and our policies, you have to be domiciled in that country to be able to operate to another country. So both of these policies and strategies of the countries, sometimes differences do arise, and in some instances they begin to erode the connectivity and economic development. Next one is different levels of development and deep concern of individual countries. In some countries, why they would not go to for Yamasuku Declaration or increase in frequencies? They believe that some areas are very strong. They'll be able to gobble the operators there and take over the market. And hence, there's very little progress since 1999 in terms of Yamasuku Declaration. And also, there's this fear of unknown. If you take our neighbor, Sweden, the attractive market, very big economic activity between those. Take the Portuguese speaking countries, Mozambique and Angola. We don't understand what the problem is increasing the frequency between those countries. Those of us who have tried to fly to Rwanda, they would know that you need to book 500 pounds to be able to get seats to Rwanda, whether you use South African Airways or even TAG. And we're only allowed to fly to Rwanda, not any other country in that vast country. The challenge is that our bilaterals, should be aimed at giving good a competitive advantage to our operators. It's a battle that we need to fight because the other side also comes with the same objective, that what can be best for our operators in this agreement. The executive agents, according to Herman's decision in 1999, endorsed in 2000, was that an executive agency would be established, and this agency would monitor and where the issues that come into the picture. That agency has not been established, and this is one drawback. Competition regulation. Different states have different competition laws and regulations, and this poses a bit of a challenge. Although the Joint Competition Commission has been established, which is based in Kigali, for SADC, so that we harmonize our competition laws in SADC, it has been established. We think this will alleviate some of the problems we are facing. The other one is the dispute settling mechanism. In case of the dispute on Yamasuku, who resolve the dispute, to oversight the two countries and bring a solution to it. Appropriate policies are spoken. Clear and equitable rules for the location of time slots to establishment of slot and the slot coordination committee as regards major airlines comprising airport authorities, airlines, civil aviation, etc. This is one potential issue for operators. How do you locate slots? And who do we give the ideal slot and get the west where they fly at 12 at night? It's a contentious issue. And one of the things that we need to do to ensure that this process is done very transparent and also it takes into account the needs of the industry, therefore in this regard, the tourists and tourism as a whole. I'll take the sheets. Thank you.
I was looking here, we was a very, very much behind time. Why don't we then agree that we allow the next presenter? Because at about 10:15 we have to go for break, for a short break, and we should have finished the presenters, three presenters. Do you have
Chair, I would rather we dealt with each one individually because your thoughts are then quite directed. And we're going to ask questions later. It's going to take a similar amount of time to ask the questions then anyway.
That is a view of the commission. Is that a view of the commission? Are we all agree? That we take questions. What is going to be important, Honorable Shah, is for you when we do take questions to come closer so that we can look into how we manage the time.
Chairperson, sorry. I suggest that we think to the process.
You've been seconded, Honorable Shah. If you may come closer, then we can take the questions.
Chair, I suggested that because that's how it was yesterday. But in the interest of my colleague who's running short time, he wants to listen to the presentation. So I don't mind accommodating his...
to the program, I believe. Let's then allow the next presenter. Looking further down on the program, we are at 11:20 to 12:40 discussions. I think that is the appropriate time whereby we can, if members hold your respect, just take some notes and allow the next presenter to take us through. Conservation issues impacting on tourism or not, the national energy strategy. That's Mr. Twala and Mr. Don Clutton.
Chair, with your permission, can I ask if a hard copy of your presentation is available to the committee? It is not. Chairperson, thank you very much for the opportunity. I must say it's always a bit of a challenge to follow the share order. And also to make sure that I don't say anything that can compromise us in front of the shareholder. But thank you for the opportunity, and Chair, it's really been here today. I think it's been a good opportunity to get the insights and some valuable information that's been shared, and I hope that we can make a contribution this morning to further that understanding and that discussion. So in terms of the presentation, we've been asked to look at current aviation issues and impacts on tourism, obviously with a big and a strong context within our sphere, which is the airports, and I hope to share a few slides with you. First, just as a general overview, and Chair, I was just reflecting. We said, you know, sometimes you have to look back before you look forward. And our company celebrated 2 months ago, we celebrated our 20 years of existence. And we actually had an opportunity to do exactly that, to say, what has this journey been all about? And there's a lot of detail there, and we also shared slides, so I'm not going to go through all of that, but it has been a journey when we started in 1994. From initially being told that we not necessarily have all the skills to run an airbus company, so we were then in a scenario where we looked for a foreign partner to give us that capability. At that stage, Airport de Roma, they came on board. And that was a period 94 to 98. 98 they departed, PRD took over that component of the shares. And shortly after that we went and we started also exploring an international strategy, which did with our shareholder in terms of looking at, particularly within BRICS context, and we got involved in Mumbai Airport, and that concession has been running for a number of years. And subsequent to that, we've had a lot of local happenings, particularly in the run-up to 2010. Our airports all got their facelifts, and we built a new airport in Durban, commissioned all of that. In the last year, Chair, we also then we were awarded a concession for Rulos, which is in Sao Paulo, Brasilia. And all of those events, I think, have been key milestones on this journey of the last 20 years. So that's just a bit of context. Chair, if I can just share with you and with the committee, and I think you can see all that. I'm not going to run into too much detail. But obviously, we've got a particular focus. We want to make sure that we match world-class airports for the benefit of all our shareholders. And we do then drive that through a very strong value proposition. Our values are very, very important. And in terms of that, efficiency and a customer-focused business is and remains key. We have a network of airports, the local, the SAVTY Limited Stable, 36 million passengers that we process through that on an annual basis. Subsequent, as I mentioned, we also go well both in Brazil and Mumbai. And you can see the airport, the size is there, they're significant airports, they're quite big. In fact, my colleague in Sao Paulo is from Cape Town. He's now the ops director, one of our South African colleagues. He reminds me often that he's now managing the biggest airport in the Axis stable. Chair, when the minister yesterday spoke of South, I think that is a key issue for us to reflect on going forward. It certainly has got all of the opportunity. We have all of the capability. We have the capacity. We must make it happen. And we recognize the fact that there are market forces that are at play, but certainly that is a key opportunity. Chair, I would like to highlight one issue and maybe use this opportunity. It's just to say that the whole issue of transit visas obviously is understood in terms of the context and the importance of transit visas. But transit visas and cost, and not so much the cost, but just the whole process of doing a transit visa, is certainly not fully supportive of such a strategy. It will probably promote a situation where anyone that's trying to find the shortest route through might then try and find an alternative. So, I think there was talk yesterday around the e-visas and how that would accelerate. I think there was Chenamla correction, but if these are initially, if it's a whole 6 week period and that can come down to 1 week period, 10 days, I understand that's the type of parameters we're looking at. But once visas is and will be an issue. If you go through Europe these days, most of us will recognize the fact that you only try and go through Dubai, Schiphol, even Frankfurt, but you try and avoid those airports where you have the transit visas. Jay, this is just a quick to give you a sense of what work we've done over the last 5 years when we invested quite significantly in local airports. The yellow or the orange box, they represent capacity, and then the blue or teal, they represent where we are. So you can see there's some capacity that's available and at our disposal. This capacity obviously is important in terms of making sure that we not only are able to process the required passenger numbers, but that we're also able to do it at the right service levels and also within the safety and security parameters. But I think the key message on this slide is that we have provided some capacity, and we have an opportunity now where for a while we're not necessarily making any significant investments. Chair, this helps just to articulate what does the airport mean for this country. A recent study done by KPMG, and you'll see that in terms of 75,000 jobs to the economy, an estimated 0.13 percentage points of South African GDP on an average annual basis. And just the project alone and the traffic growth has contributed an estimated 7.8 billion in tax revenues. Chair, this is a key slide that I would like to draw your attention to, and the colleagues in the room. Over time, it is becoming clear to us that GDP growth is a key driver of traffic volume and growth. You can see the correlation is there. It is really, obviously, and we feel, we see it very often first at the airport when the economy is starting to take a beating. And that correlation is clear. And that is the real driver of traffic volume for the airports. Okay, the airport charges have often in the past, maybe even in recent times, come up for discussion, and the extent to which they could be enabling or disabling is obviously the source of the key debates from time to time. I think the one issue that we just again would like to highlight is that often the term airport taxes are used broadly. A small component of that is really the APSA charge. In today's terms, you'll see there, regulated charges, APSA, it costs 120 Rand, that's the APSA component for domestic, 249 regional and 328 international. There are other charges such as the SA, the Civil Aviation Agency Security Charge, ACF, passenger charge, and that's for doing the baggage reconciliation and the CETA charges. And then the airlines have the fuel charges and surcharges and other insurance costs. And all of that sits in one bracket, and that's called the airport tax as well. Actually, a small component. Typically on a domestic flight, 120 Rand of that is the airport component. This is the regulations going forward, and if one looks at this slide in terms of charges, it's important to say, well, what's happening now going forward? We've obviously, I think a lot of us spent time on what's behind us. But we are in the process of firming up our 10-year plan, and we're doing that with all of the key stakeholders, our shareholder, the airlines, particularly at association level, IATA, all the key players. And in terms of the plan, we see a potential 45 billion rand worth of investment that will happen. This investment plan is, and we try and give you a sense of how that is spread over the years. Chair, one of the learnings, if I may say, of the last 5 years, is if you have all of your projects in 1 year finishing, it has a huge impact in terms of operationalizing the facilities, but also what it does at a tariff level. So there's a good logic for saying spread those projects on a more even basis, try and flatten the demand curve. But also very important is just to note, Chair, that the 45 billion is made up of various components.
obviously very important always will be the refurb and replacement and the statutory compliance, efficiency and technology, and the capitalized interest. The capacity projects will be informed and will be triggered only if we really see the growth that we need to achieve. Now, we cannot trigger those projects unless there's a sound business case for that. But we are positive, we are hopeful, we think that this scenario of growth bouncing back will become a reality. And therefore we can't then find ourselves in a position that we haven't planned, we haven't thought through. So the basis on which we are preparing our plan for the next 10 years is to actually do a number of scenarios. We have a base case, and we have a low case, and we have a high case. And depending on how the economy is going to respond, we are able then to position accordingly. Okay, but even with that type of investment, let's for a minute assume we're going to spend $45 billion. Then it's important to reflect on this slide. Just to tell you that given the fact that we've raised the asset base in our company quite significantly, and given the fact that we are spreading these investments over the next number of years on a more equal basis, we're able to say to you going forward, and maybe to do orientation 2013-14 current year, we have a direct increase of 5.5% that has just been effected. Next year we're looking at another 5%. The year after that, share 3%. And then the following year after that, we will have essentially no increase. And that is mindful and inclusive of the 45 billion rand investment. This means that should we not spend all the investment that we currently have in the plan, because of whatever reason, that is then eventually endorsed and supported by all stakeholders and by the shareholders, we will actually see tariffs not staying at zero but going negative. So I think it does provide the opportunity to say to SAPTY Limited that, one, we have the capacity. Two, we know that the charge in the next 5 years will certainly not be prohibitive or crippling. And three, it gives us an opportunity to engage, and we've been busy with that for a number of, in fact, almost 2 years now. Through the guidance and leadership of our shareholder, we engage in industry. And we have said to each other that something, you know, we have to do things different going forward. We've all achieved good success, but we've all learned along the way. There are things that we can do different and things that we can do better. And based on that, we want to make sure that the way we package our development and our growth going forward is such that it is enabling, that it is supported by all the entities, including the airlines. The airlines have to endorse. There's no such thing for an airline to have a growth strategy if the airports don't expand, because where will you land? Where will you? So it has to be a win-win situation. And we've had very good leadership through the shareholder taking us on that journey. The regulatory committee has been recently appointed a new committee, and there's a process. And there's a number of things that we're trying to just make sure we'll work a bit better going forward, particularly around if there are any issues around disputes, how do we deal with that, pricing policy, the whole issue of saying to pre-funding of facilities. One of the things that would have helped in the previous 5 years is if we were able to get tariff on the investment we build. Typically to build a new airport or major infrastructure takes a number of years, 3 to 5 years. And if you're able to introduce the tariffs whilst you're building, then you also minimize the impact. Where if you only do it at the end, it has a huge spike in impact. Chair, there was a talk, and I think you mentioned all the issue of, apologies, the woman Tatwala that spoke about the slot coordination. Critical issue. And again, through the department, we recently were able to get the regulations summed up. And the allocation system now is going to be far more robust than what it used to be. The next step, I believe, this is just a personal view, I think the allocation model can work to a certain point, but then you have to do pricing. So that if an airline is prepared to operate in a time that is less peak, obviously are you able then to look at a different price of the peak hour? And how can you use that to drive or to flatten your demand and manage capacity going forward? But here for me, very important is just to say to you, that I'm very encouraged by the way the industry has responded to this.
all shareholders, all the stakeholders and the shareholder will engage in it. All, and I'm talking across the board, whether it's the airline associations, the pilots association, everyone recognizes the fact that we need to do something different. The engagement are happening on a continuous basis, and we're all working hard on finding a way forward. So, Chair, just to give you a snapshot on the future of sustainability, and not just for AXA, it's for everyone, we have to be sustainable. The growth, we have to have growth in the business. If we don't grow, we can stagnate. And it's not just about receiving funds, we also have to look at how we can innovatively drive traffic. I know a number of the problems, and a lot of the provinces are very active. North Flat and the influence. There are entities that are focused on how to grow and bring more, and I think that is growth is key. At the same time, we have to be efficient and we have to be able to do more with less. See, the capacity that we have today, we cannot just take that for granted. We actually have to say that if I use, and pardon me for using my own airport, Cape Town is designed for 14 million passengers. If we're able to do 15 or 16 or 17 million, why not before we invest again? You know, our ability, therefore, to take more out of the capacity and to do that in an innovative way is going to be key, but it's not just about one entity, and this is where the collaboration the industry level comes through. And we've seen very good examples of how the airline fraternity with ground handlers, with the government authorities, what airports company can do that. The one example, Chair, that I just need to mention to you is when we, 3 years ago, took a decision with the airline leadership, top leadership of the airlines, to create an environment that where we could do collaborative operational management at the airports. The airports were running on average on an on-time performance, the airports and the airlines, and I'm going to talk from an airport perspective, we would record on-time performance of in the region of just over 70%, 73-74% on a regular basis. Chair, last year Cape Town, which is part of the network and which is close to the other airports, closed on just short of 90%. In fact, the indicators this year is that next year we will exceed 90% on time. So all flights in and out 90% of them will be on time. Chair, the airlines, he can best speak to this, but the model that is often referred to is that if you are able to bring 5% of additional on-time performance, that essentially represents an aircraft. You save an aircraft. And when we talk about these opportunities for efficiency, the key must be for everyone's benefit so that we can all buy into that and all support that. Relevance. GM, if we remain relevant, not only as a in terms of our different roles, but also the destination, we will not exist. So relevance is important. That ability to continue add value is going to be key. And then business performance, excellence, growth of the organization's people. And those, the biggest assets we have is not necessarily the bricks and mortar. It does reside with the people. Our strategic campaign forward is high performance and engaging team. Finalization of an economic regulation legislation and funding framework, acceleration of sustainability and transformation programs, strengthen business excellence, identify and securing new business. Chair, in this regard, obviously the BRICS have been a focus for us in terms of the engagements with our audit shareholder, the next big push, and we're already very active in that in Africa. We're also particularly mindful of the strategies that are being adopted by all of the airlines, so that we are in sync with that and making sure that there is alignment. And build win-win partnerships with our stakeholders and ensure that we deliver shareholder value for the next 20 years. Thank you, Chair.
Very much. As we agree, I'm having another question to all of us. We're supposed to be having tea. Are we able to go and have tea, or do we proceed?
Chair, I suggest we finish the session.
Agreed. The next presenter, Mr. Arnold Muniz, SAM.
Buddha, good morning. Members of the portfolio committee and members of provincial committees, all protocols observed. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to participate in this discussion. I just want to start by apologizing on behalf of the CEO of African Airways, who will not join me today. Other pressing matters came up. He was actually going to give you a surprise visit, but unfortunately, things did not happen that way. I'm also grateful, Honorable Chair, that my colleague, Zakele, has spoken extensively on the Amasuko decision, because it was part of my presentation, and it is a pertinent issue for us as the airline, which I think delivers a lot of value to not only to the airline, but to the country and to the continent. So I'm grateful that you allowed Zakele to take that responsibility, but I will also touch on the Amasuko decision. Because for us as an airline, it's important that we constantly come to you as our shareholders. And I want to say to Dion, if you think it's difficult speaking after your shareholder, think about me. Every one of you is my shareholder. Without you, I don't have any shareholders. So you can imagine how difficult it is for me. What I wanted to do, Honorable Chair, is to take you through maybe what Zakaria spoke about in terms of regulating the skies, and then drill down a little bit further into the different interests that reside in two distinct parties, who are the authorities and the airlines, and then bring down to the topic of my discussion, which is strategic intent and unlocking tourism for South Africa from the international and the African, African continent, and then also briefly touch on the dynamic environment in which we operate, and then end up by sharing with you some developmental imperatives. Like I said, regulating the skies, as far as we are concerned, the text, the rules and regulations on the one side, which talk to the bilateral service agreement. We call them conventions of convenience, because what that actually does is it gives each country an opportunity to think about their own convenience first, and then they go to a convention with another country. And for us, this is a long one here, which we must not even start talking about. Then we talk about open skies, and this is where the IP resides. In terms of open skies, again, it's a question of countries thinking of the discussion and dialogue and saying, are we talking to friends or are we talking to enemies or foes? And the result, obviously, then sort of points you in the direction of whether we're considered a friend or foe. And then the freedom of the skies, Zakele spoke about them extensively again, from 1 to 6. But obviously, for us, the intention is always good. The intention is to have fair play, encourage development, and establish harmony on the continent, and also to make sure that we develop leadership in terms of how do we develop our countries, and then obviously to talk to the growth aspect of what we do. The net effect, on the other hand, for me, is the great part that talks about the actual dialogue and protocol that takes place when you address these things. And then once we're dialoguing, then you come up with the regulation. And, Honorable Chair, the regulation, unfortunately, tend to end up with protectionism. And I think we have to be bold and rational about this thing and talk about protectionism. Because not any one of the 53 or 54 countries on the continent is relieved from protectionism. We are, unfortunately, we have to deal with protectionism all over. And even ourselves as Africa, we have considered to be a protectionist attempt just by the Tanzanians up against us to say, why don't you allow the yet unnamed airline that wants to start operating from our country? And this obviously leads to discord. And this is what the regulatory framework does, definitely. So obviously, the intention is to have what we call partners of conveyance. We are supposed to be conveying people and cargo. But the regulatory framework itself is crafted by authorities. We have a very good intention, by the way, of enabling development of the aviation industry. And the authorities come in terms of government, regulatory, but on the other side, for us as players, industry players, airlines, airports, ground handling agents, whether the rules, customs, police, immigration, all the industry players have a role to play from an interest for their shareholders. And I think this is where the water begins to get muddy, Honorable Chair. Because once you begin to think about yourself, first and foremost, either as an airline or as a single entity, who begin to take your eye off focus of being a relevant player in the developmental space. And I think that is where we need to constantly remind everybody to go back to that area of saying, yes, you are an industry player, but remember you are also part of a bigger team, and you are actually much more important to the continent and to the country when you play in the bigger team. As long as we remain focused on what we are doing as an individual entity, we will not actually achieve the objective. And just maybe to look at the early strategy, is it an opportunity or a threat? Some of the things that we want to talk about, Honourable Chair, is the resource allocation has to be in tandem with the strategic intent of the country, of the continent. And of course, what we also agree is that this business, especially airline industry, is a capital-intensive business, so much that we are all accused of being in a luxury business as compared to a private industry. So, Honourable Chair, when you travel, people get to say, wow, this gentleman is lucky. They actually don't realize that you are actually working. And we also spoke about air traffic contribution to the entire industry, as well as to the GDP growth. And we say one in every 12 jobs is related to air traffic. And then the good thing about this, Honourable Chair, is that the ROI is immediate, and it can be sustainable in the long term. As long as the plans and strategies are in place and they are followed, the ROI is almost immediate. And then affiliate industries also benefit from air traffic. We are saying that yes, we build an immediate bridge, but there are service providers both up and downstream who benefit immediately from the airlift uplift opportunity. But then again, it is an opportunity in that the majority of the revenue, especially for us in South Africa, is generated in strong currencies, that is the euro, the US dollar. So we want them to start saying, in as much as domestic industry plays a very big role, I totally support the initiative to focus on domestic industry, but we also must say we need to play a big role in those areas where strong countries and start earning those euros and USDs, so that they come into our country and start developing or supplementing the resources that we have from our shareholders. And the significant portion of our costs are also built in local currency, which actually makes it a double dip. Then in that case, you're earning in euros or in US dollars, and most of your costs are in local currency. Wow, you're actually gaining a double. And then the allies strategy with the national objectives, for example, our youth, our women project, once we align those with the opportunity that comes with the area, you find that there's a significant uptake. And then, of course, the controlled utilization of our national assets in terms of our parks and wildlife and so forth. Just to share with you, Honourable Chair, some of the challenges that airlines face, and this is not only particular or peculiar to South African countries, airlines. 3 years in a row, the profitability of airlines is under a lot of stress. Specifically after 2008, during the global financial meltdown, we have been battling to get back to any sustainable operations. Significant contributions are the price of coca and of love, but also the price of doing business, especially on the African continent, is a significant factor in terms of how we as SAA remain profitable. For the benefit of the Commission, Honourable Chair, I can share with you that the best of us airlines in the world achieve a 0.21% return on investment. That has been the significant in the past 3 years. That is a very, very huge ask of you, my shareholders, to say continue to support me financially, because at the end of the day, if I don't play in this space, other people will come and take whatever belongs to us. So the strategic intent, if I can summarize, Honourable Chair, is to have a situation where we enable movement of people and goods, but also to enhance the living standards of the people and the communities in which we operate and sell, and give everybody the opportunity to pursue their own dream and venture in the future. But on the one side, we have the investment, which is almost a God-given. Nobody owns the air that we fly in. The natural resources are God-given. So I think what we need to do, Honourable Chair, is to agree that the only significant, or the only organization that that owns the resources is the government, which means the people. And then there is this triangle of imbalance in between, which talks about the regulations that we have to operate within. My colleagues actually spoke about quite a number of them. Dion also mentioned a few of those regulations. We're sitting right at the top of the pyramid. Immediately under that, there are opportunities that everybody can see. I think we are in one of the most unpopular fields of business, Honorable Chair. Second, maybe the Springbok, Panama, because everybody else believes they can do a better job than us. There are so many opportunities. I walk down the street, anybody, from the street vendor to the cafe owner, they tell me how they can do a better job of developing the tourism industry. And then immediately after the opportunity sits the subtle issue of financing. Where does the money come from? They have to be an investment. And then the black box, as far as we're concerned, Honorable Chair, is competition. Competition is furious, it is robust, it is unfortunately unavoidable. It will come whether we like or not, it is coming. But if we are able to navigate this investment and the triangle of our opportunities, Honorable Chair, we end up with the benefits, and the benefits are very simple. You get dollars and you get living conditions that are improved. So, here is what I think we should do, Honorable Chair. The first thing that we should do is to focus on our core business. In other words, have we defined the markets that we want to sell? Once we have defined those markets, we must service these markets and give the existing customers the best things that they want. One of my favorite part-time, the Honorable Chair, is to read back about people who have been successful and those that have failed. And I refer to one guy called Steve Jobs, who said, the one thing that you need to understand is the more complex things become, the more difficult your business becomes. So simplify things. Customers don't know what they want until we show them what they want. So let's serve these customers by telling them what we have in South Africa and on the continent. They will come. Earlier on, somebody spoke about serving South Africa as a long-haul destination. And I have a very strong view against that because I personally believe that we have allowed other people to define us as a long-haul. Unless and until we start writing our own stories, people continue to tell us that we are long-haul. But the question you ask yourself is long-haul from where? And then we must focus on meeting the needs of the people that are traveling and make strategic decisions. So, Honorable Chair, this is the first part, the core business that we need to address. Once we've got this in place, we then go to the adjacent business, which is exploiting new business to us, not to other people. And we must be very careful in saying this is new to us, not to other people. And then asking ourselves constantly this question, what else can be done in order for us to be able to attract tourism into our country and into the continent? And then enter adjacent markets. In as much as all these markets are in core markets, they are markets that are adjacent. For example, we have now come to an era where customers mostly don't want to go to one country or one destination on holiday. They are talking about multiple destination holidays. So we should be able to say, when customers come to South Africa, let's sell them in conjunction some of the other regions or even further afield, because that is what the customers want. And then the one part of your Honorable Chair that needs to be addressed significantly is transformational. How do we develop breakthroughs in terms of our thinking, in terms of our product offering, in terms of our interaction with the market? We need to invent new products, and that means new products, not just brushing up old products and rehashing them, making them new. And then we also have to create new markets. New markets comes in terms of market segmentation, targeting new customers and think to the future, what's going to happen into the future. We can't think about what we call the FTQ generation as we think about the baby boomers. The FTQ are the Facebook, Twitter, or Quit generation. What is it that is going to drive them towards tourism going into the future? Which brings me to what we call the dynamic environment. On the top part, sorry, the color is not so clear, but I'm talking about influencing the having dynamic. We need to come to an understanding that the needs that are addressed by travel, be it business, leisure, or specialty. And then the size of the population is insignificant. We always talk about it. People tend to ask, you are at the bottom of the continent, and we say, so what? That's where the attraction is. The population size that we have is significant enough to be able to have all these airlines wanting to come to operate in our country, in our continent. And then we must signify the visitor profile. And On the other hand, once we have identified these things, we begin to see what is the spending power that comes from either the needs of travelers, the population size, the location, or the profile, and then what sort of traffic flows are emerging, and of course what revenue do we derive from it. Which makes me come to the first point I want to bring to you, Honorable Chair and Commission. We must make sure that the message we take across any market that we serve is that we are open for business. Anything that we do contrary to this will actually work against us. When we say we are open for business, we must make things happen. And then the fact message, Honorable Chair, is that we either transform or we perish. Yes, Zakaria spoke about the stupid decision of creating an enabling environment and proactive approach to development and so forth. But here is where we're coming from. The business model, not only for South Africa or for the African people that matter, is ever changing. From being rigid, inward looking, being regulated and non-nonsense. So many times we're not allowed to take photographs in airport and so forth. We're always reactive and rules driven. To where we are today, the business environment is flexible, it's outward looking, completely deregulated, is user-friendly, very proactive and business-driven. Point number two, under the chair, is the ease of doing business is what drives tourism. And I point to the issue of trans-visa regime. I don't want to belabor the point, but the trans-visa regime has significantly cost us, as African Airways, and South Africa as a country, because the perception is much more, to us, much more valuable than the dollar cents that we gain from the transit visas that people apply for. And of course, for us, the innovation dividend comes from being able to offer competitive fares, which leads to help customers, new products and services, more routes that bring a diversified visitor base, and the increased traffic means boom to the tourism industry, and growth of jobs in aviation and related industry. Now, Honorable Chair, one thing I want to bring out from this particular slide is to say there are what we call air travel influencers, and any of these things influence people traveling by air, be it political, labor, borders, and regional issues. Unfortunately, in as much as we have so much information at our fingertips, people still get their geography confused. So it's not then unusual for an American to ask, oh, you're coming from South Africa, do you know Jenny from Kenya? Because for them, the border won't mean anything. But we must also understand that the new technologies give us an opportunity to be able to influence these air travelers by either social media, and then this offers new markets in terms of being able to specifically zero in and talk to specific markets. The regulatory framework also has to be influenced by these technologies, so that we open up trade and markets in terms of how we view ourselves from a globalization point of view. So the third point, Honorable Chair, to say the progressive environment that we need to have opens up growth opportunities, and these opportunities are infinite. As long as we think outward and we think, how do we capitalize? So the benefits, for example, are job creation, opening the world, training, prosperity, development, and so forth, and obviously harmony of tables. My last slide, Honorable Chair, to say that new thinking calls for progressive policies, and one thing that we must do is to establish what we call the all-of-state approach. Because fairness is not an isolated activity that resides in Parliament or that resides in Ministry of Transport or only in Ministry of Tourism. Everybody must be involved, and this all-of-state approach has been proven to be successful in some countries here on the African continent, and also abroad outside the continent. The second thing we must do, Honorable Chair, is focus on sustainable development. The moment we start to focus on quick fixes, we are going to miss the big picture. Because the quick fixes only act as a band-aid, but sustainable development is the bigger picture, which involves a lot of thinking and a lot of involvement for stakeholders. Infrastructure development, Dion spoke about the airport, but I also want to go further and say, infrastructure does not necessarily mean airport. It means a lot of other things. Because for people to get to the airport, there must be the road. And people don't always want to travel through airport. They also want to travel the seaport. So the whole infrastructure conundrum is addressed. And as long as infrastructure develops in certain place, the economy grows. And the guest spoke about how economic growth is also determines the growth of traffic and traffic and tourism. And lastly, our Honourable Chair, an all-inclusive policy framework approach where we need to try and get everybody involved when policies are being formulated, so that the pros and cons of policies are then debated extensively and robustly. And then once the agreement is reached, if we agree that this was going to happen, then we must also always make sure that we follow through. So we must constantly innovate how we do business, update the brand South Africa. And there's this radio station called YIWFM, which stands for What's In It For Me. We must be able to address that radio station, because everybody can only participate if they know what exactly is in this thing for them. And our stakeholder relationships, not necessarily within the country or within the continent, but across countries and across continents, are significant. If we don't do this, Honourable Chair, we might end up with successes or pockets of successes that might not necessarily achieve the tourism that we're trying to make. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks again.
Are we going to have the discussion now or after the tea?
Why is it at 11:20, 12:40 is the discussion?
We should be having a break now, but I'll request members to just sneak out and take whatever and bring it in here as we continue. I'll then request Mr. Nichols, as it not.
Transportation as the cost area gets reduced. So typically, of course, there will be total brass stimulation. They will stimulate the mantra of both existing tablets as well as the new mantra, A tablet, with a subsequent economic benefit. Now, that move has been on the way in the whole southwest since the mid-70s, and South Africa really for the last decade or bit. Now, the state of low-cost carrier growth globally has been as follows. Right now, as we speak, 65% of global air traffic is delivered by low-cost carriers. 50% of all the passengers between Johannesburg and Cape Town is carried by low-cost carriers. 50% of short-haul traffic globally is delivered by LCCs. And 60% of narrow-body aircraft forward orders are placed by low-cost carriers. So if we look at the recent past, growth has been in the low-cost carrier domain, and looking forward in terms of aircraft orders, short-haul space, definitely low-cost carrier growth is there. Low-cost carriers has, in 20 years, achieved what traditional carriers achieved in 80 years in terms of volume growth. Now, with that as background, low-cost carriers and aviation in general has a positive effect in terms of GDP contribution in a country, both to the extent of tourism stimulation, but also stimulating economic activity. The same relation that exists between tele-density and economic growth exists between transportation and airlift and economic growth. So if we look at an airline like Mango, on average, excluding our fuel expense, we contribute to the economy 400 million rand per annum to a local supply chain base. An additional 320 million rand economic benefit flows to our employees as well as the employees of our suppliers. There's an approximate 50 demand effect, a benefit of approximately 1.1 billion rand per annum, according to a study recently conducted by Oxford Economics. Additionally, the activity that a low-cost carrier stimulates has economic benefit to other state-owned companies. If we look at combined between AXA, Treasury, as well as DTI in the forms of NIPS obligations, there's an additional 750 million rand a year in economic benefit that flows towards these entities. That in turn gets reinvested in support of the infrastructure that enables tourism and economic trade in our country. Apart from the more direct GDP contribution effect, aviation also has a substantial employment effect. It is estimated that every airline, any time that an airline starts operations at a given airport, that you generate in the order of 100 direct and indirect jobs at that specific airport or intermediate route. In the case of Mango, we currently employ 543 people, with which we carry approximately 2 million passengers per annum. And of these 543 people, they support, in turn, 5,000 people, family members, children, wife, husbands, downstream. And approximately 7,400 jobs are further supported through Mango supply, as well as the employees spent in local shops and so on. There's a catalytic effect in terms of employment within tourism in the order of 9,000 jobs through Mango's activities. And then, of course, it's worthwhile noting that aviation employment is typically a high yield level of employment. The average income for employees in aviation is typically almost twice that of the national average. So, in essence, high-value jobs get created through the economic activity stimulated by low-cost carriers and also the carriers for the matter. Now, how does that translate into actual economic benefit for a country? And there's plenty of examples around the country, around the world. If we look at some international precedents, the basic premise is that low-cost carriers reduce the cost of airlift for tourism benefits, but specifically also stimulating economic benefits in terms of trade and industry. So if we look at the Spanish market, post 9/11, a bulk of the growth in the Spanish market was driven by low-cost carrier entry. By 2008, low-cost carriers accounted for just over 50% of the total passenger seat supply and passenger transport within Spain and to Spain as a tourism and trade partner. The overall market has showed continued growth because of the stimulation effect by LCCs, despite Aaron's reference earlier today in terms of the economic suppression effect of 2008-2009, low-cost carriers ended up stimulating additional demand and making that trough less deep than it would have been otherwise. So if we look at tangible benefits in terms of Spain, 612,000 tourism jobs supported within the Spanish economy. 40 billion euros per annum in direct and catalytic demand, tourism demand effect. 149 million passengers per year transported, of which 55% at the present day comes from low-cost carriers. On the graph on the right, you effectively see a cost percentage travel by air, and you'll see that Spain has, over the last decade, moved up that chart to the far left-hand side. When you look at that, however, we are still a little bit too far on the right-hand side of this chart in terms of propensity to travel by air. Now, I will say that when we did research in 2005, pre-launch Mango, that ratio of propensity to travel by air was substantially lower than it is today. So progress is being made. But as a general average, so applicants travel less by air than, say, a population of Thailand, for example. And therefore, we do not get the full economic benefit of a connected community and population. If we look at some local applications, for example, we'll use Mango as an example of Bloemfontein, where we operate into the route Cape Town, Cape Town Bloemfontein. We entered in 2006, end of 2006. In so doing, there was a single source supply on that particular route. By Mango entering that route, we provided additional seat supply as well as choice and visibility of Bloemfontein as a point to be connected with Cape Town as a port city. The outcome, the route has more or less doubled in size within a 5-year period. 20 direct jobs created in Mango and in Bloemfontein, and over the last 6 years, more than 500,000 passengers, low-cost carrier passengers, traveling between the cities of Cape Town, with the consequent economic effects and benefits in both sides of this route and both cities. If I look at an African example, Mango in December entered the Joburg Zanzibar region. In December 2012, South nationals accounted for 1.6% of the total arrivals in Zanzibar as that Mango's entry into the route. Following 6 months of operations, by June this year, South Africans accounted made up 9% of total arrivals in Zanzibar within a 6-month period. 80% of those passengers traveled on services of Mango. So from economic benefit effect to the island of Zanzibar, you can clearly see how demand is stimulated by low price offering being available and then the economic benefit being derived within this country, city in this case. Now, local carriers do more than just add a low price. And when I speak about a low price, as a quick example of comparing a low-cost carrier, full service carrier on Joburg, Cape Town, Joburg, Durban, same aircraft type, we'd see a price differential of roughly approximately 50%. That a low-cost carrier can provide that service in a sustainable fashion. Our on-rate statement of the very low levels of return on equity, return on investments, and return on sales. It's a well-known fact that return on equity investment in aviation in the last 20 years was on order 4%, substantially lower than what we can get from interest-bearing deposits. I'm happy to say, though, that low-cost carriers can bring pricing down and increase and improve margins. As an average, the low-cost carrier cohort's margins are higher than that of full-service carriers in the last 5 years. But it's not just about price. It is also about the marketing visibility that low-cost carriers, through their promotion activity, afford to tourism and to destination marketing. Now, I've circulated some of the Mango juice on board magazine around the room. We typically carry on average 75% tourism or destination-related content in these magazines. We've got a social media presence between ourselves and our competing local carrier in South Africa. We maintain position number one and number two in terms of the most well-supported social media presence in the country. So in the case of Mango, we reach approximately 250,000 people per week communicating specials, promotions, and so forth. Additionally, low-cost carrier approach to business is slightly different. They typically go and find non-traditional distribution channels. In the case of Mango, we end up leveraging the likes of ShopRite, Checkers, Edcon, Momentum. And in practice, what that means is that when we want to market a destination like Scoopies, hypothetically, the opportunity that we've got available to us is to leverage the power of a ShopRite, Checkers. Got 600 locations around and the third largest marketing spend in the country to bring our message home to the general man in the street. The person can then go and buy the affordable low-cost carrier ticket and place it on, say, Edgar's or Jet's account and sales over 12 months. So it's about making things affordable and truth and affordable, but also accessible. Focus carriers also are engaged in very intentional and specific tourism promotion initiatives, typically centered around events and destination and offerings, and where we actively cooperate with the likes of tourism bodies such as SA Tourism, as well as developmental bodies such as West Group. All in all, what Mangala aims to do is to leverage our complete value chain from start to finish. As we sit, we are busy rolling out a dynamic packaging capability, which will now see a situation where we can take hotel, car, a sporting event, a gate spot at Kruger Park, for example, all packaged and combined in a dynamic manner with a low and attractive fare, and payable and sold on credit terms, for example, or conveniently accessible means to the consumer. So I think that in conclusion, as one of the last clips, last year we engaged in a bucket list campaign which saw us putting substantial marketing behind 12 specific destinations in the country. By combining affordability, efficiency, and sustainability, whether you're a local carrier or a full service carrier, you end up bringing down the cost of travel. And bringing down the cost of travel has got a positive effect on both tourism as well as economic development in the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, we are moving to, am I correct here? Professor Tempatu? I can see that you are very much entertained.
Thank you, Chair, members of the Portfolio Committee, and other dignitaries present here, colleagues. My name is Tima Dude from the South African Weather Service. I'll be giving a talk on climate change and tourism. I was requested to speak on the topics tourism in the global economy. That has been spoken about extensively yesterday. I don't think I'm going to add into that. Tourism climate interactions were also spoken about yesterday. Implications of climate change and climate policy for tourism. Maybe not that much on climate policy. Responding to adaptation to mitigating challenges and role of the National Meteorological Services, the weather services, and then draw some conclusions and recommendations. My talk is my premise mainly on the Davos Declaration on Climate Change in 2007 and its runner-up, the 2003 Declaration in Tunisia on Climate Change and Tourism, as well as the World Climate Change Conference, which issued a white paper on weather and climate information for tourism, and then reflect on the commitment that the global community, the WTC and UNWTO, aspirational commitments that they have made in order to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The 2007 Davos Declaration came up with a very strong statement that the scientific evidence is clear. Climate change must be considered the greatest challenge for sustainable tourism in the 21st century. It built a foundation for the realization that climate change has got an impact on tourism, and tourism in turn has got an impact on climate change in terms of the quality of tourism satisfaction, and as well as the impact of climate change on biodiversity, which would have an indirect effect on tourism. These are some of the events that have been experienced recently throughout the world. You can see the 100 circles there in the UK, records of very low temperatures, Burkina Faso, heavy rain, Argentina, heavy rain, in the US, hurricanes and all sorts of things. Over Southern Africa, 2009 was the year declared by WMO of the warmest record ever. You can see tropical cyclonic activity over the North Indian Ocean and Australia, heat waves happening throughout the world. There are various spots that have been established throughout the world. The places that are settled there on the board are showing that. However, for Africa, South America, and the Middle East are areas of lack of knowledge in order to complete that picture, to make it complete. For Africa, it is known that we have experienced water scarcity. South Africa is a water scarce country, I'm sure you all know that. Travel costs will increase, loss of biodiversity and other effects. This diagram shows the weather climate information for major tourist decisions, how the importance of climate and weather information on various time scales, on a longer time scale, on a climate time scale. Tourists need that information for destination choice, for timing their travel, for activity planning and insurance needs. On a shorter time scale, they rely on forecast for destination choice and other things, and during the trip itself, the activity itself, your weather forecast help in deciding on spending, on satisfaction, etc. This is a dual relationship between tourism and climate change. As you can see, those red arrows showing your mitigation policy, how it helps on tourism, transportation systems, and destinations, as well as the feedback loop back to climate change, tourism impact on climate change. This also emphasizes this light, your mitigation policy may increase travel costs and affect destination choice. The direct change in climate may alter recreation season and land, affect the demand for tourism, increase extreme events, and the alteration of environmental resources for tourism may alter your tourism products, your leisure, your wildlife, coral reefs, etc., in overall affecting your economic growth and security. These are some of the reported events in the publication media throughout the world. If you may, I'm not sure if you can read that bottom, you can take to Cape Town, heat wave of 2008 in France. It was in the media, the headline was Cape Town heat wave sends fires ahead of tourism season. Also in Africa News, soggy weather puts bad month for tourists, and Mozambique was also reported in that newspaper. At the same time, the BBC, 2006, reported ski resorts were sweating in warm weather in the UK. So there are reports throughout the world on relating climate and tourism. I'm going to go through these pictures, but they are showing the impacts that are likely to arise on tourism as a result of climate change. Perhaps one on the bottom right is an exciting one. The reduction in your river, swimming area, no fishing, no boating, but there's no river anymore. This is a recent publication from Business Day on Tuesday, the 8th of December 2008, from a researcher in the UK, University of Reading, assessing that there might be an increase in turbulence by between 40 and 170% as a result of climate change, resulting in flights having to avoid bad weather, having people buckling up, your buckling up time might be up there for your whole duration of flight in future, of course, and all sorts of other repercussions. If we look at the glacier for Argentina, compare that 2006 glacier with 2004, you can see the melting of ice there, same with the US in Alaska. This is one of the well-publicized impact of climate change on Mount Kilimanjaro. If you look at the reduction of ice between 1912 through 1970 to 2000, one of our friends was bio in the country. We know Sandy, the South African National Biodiversity Institute, have done saving work on looking at how climate change will impact on our biomes and ultimately on tourism. The seven biomes we have in the country are likely to be reduced by between 35% and 55% by the year 2050 to 2100. The most significant impact will be on the succulent Karoo biome of the Western Cape and the Northern Cape, which houses endemic species, a large number of endemic species. If you look at the bottom around there, it's going to disappear altogether under certain scenarios of climate change. The Nama Karoo is likely to be reduced and migrate further eastward, as shown in the bottom of the diagram. The grassland biome, which is mainly in the frost-prone areas of the central interior, the eastern side of the country and the northern part of the country, is likely also to be reduced and replaced by bushy vegetation, impacting on wildlife in those areas. The bushy encroachment will be due to higher temperatures, frost no longer being the order of the day. The other diagram, set of diagrams there on the left-hand side is showing your savanna vegetation, particularly your mopane. Under climate change, research is indicating that certain types of vegetation in the savanna biome will disappear while some will spread, will dominate. In this particular case, Andy has done work to show that mopane vegetation will encroach the southern part of the Kruger National Park, and in that way affect your mammalian population in that area, which is very crucial for tourism. Work has already been done. This program is taken for the South African Risk and Vulnerability Atlas for Cape Town under different scenarios. It's not a very clear diagram, but you can see the predicted wave ramp half meter, at 1 meter, 2 meters, resulting in the encroachment or damage to property, the beach being eaten away and property being submerged underwater. This has already happened in Cancun, Mexico. If you look at the extent on the diagram on the right-hand side, so the extent of the beach in 2006, you can see how big it was, but in 2007, it's been reduced to that much. The far right diagram is indicating damaged property as a result thereof. And of course, Cyclone Katrina of the U.S. reminded us that we don't have to wait for 2050 or 2100 for us to realize the impact of extreme weather events. This diagram is trying to show that tourism has got a part to play in the problem that we have regarding climate change. If tourism was a country, it would have featured as number 6 in terms of emissions, if you look at the ranking on the left-hand side, contributing 5% to your percentage of wealth emissions. Of course, South Africa is seated at number 14, with about 1.5% of wealth emissions. And of course, our emissions have increased over the years. If you look at South Africa there, we've increased quite significantly between 1990 and 2000 by about 10% in terms of our emissions, while other countries have seen a reduction. These are operational commitments that I spoke about earlier, that the WTTC, as well as the UNWTO, have committed to, in 2019, to have emissions reduced by 25% below their 2005 level by 2020, and by 50% by 2005. And if we continue business as usual, of course it will be that blue line which is shooting up. I've inserted this diagram to indicate what the point that was raised yesterday, I think by the Director General, the DG of Tourism, giving us a caveat that whatever actions that we take, we need to be mindful not to impact on job creation efforts not to impact negatively on the priorities of our country. This is the same sentiments that have been echoed by the Caribbean Hotel Association and the Caribbean Tourism Organization in that statement in 2007. It reads, the immediate current threats are emerging as our major tourist markets seek to take urgent and decisive action to get their own contribution to climate change. In so doing, these developed nations risk curtailing the Caribbean region's efforts to develop its societies and economies through participation in global tourism industry. So this is to say, in our health mitigation efforts, we need to reach that balance. I'm also citing at the bottom of that slide the importance of the weather and climate forecasting for the tourism industry. It's a citation from UNWTO report, the FG of UNWTO in 2005. Wrote, climate change will constitute an increasing risk for tourist operators and main destinations, with main tourism activities heavily dependent on climate and insurance policies, increasingly affected by natural hazards. Accurate weather information and forecasting of extreme climate events are becoming ever more important for tourism business. We as well as this are aware of this, not only for the tourism sector, for various other sectors, for agriculture, hydrology, and various others. We have invested a lot of money into our observation infrastructure, into lightning detection sensors, into the radar network, and your general automatic weather stations and rainfall stations in order to help us effectively deliver on our mandate. The main diagram there is indicating the usefulness of our business at various time scales, from now casting up to the climate change scale relating to tourism. Perhaps I can take the top and the bottom end of our observation, of our forecasting offerings. In terms of now casting at a very short range, our products are useful for the tourism industry, for disaster risk management, maintenance, for outdoor activity planning, for staff scheduling, etc. On a longer time horizon, they are important for site location, for facility design, for building code setting, and various other things. The top diagram there is showing kind of skill that we have built over the years from the 80s up to now. The top part of the diagram is indicating the Northern Hemisphere forecast. In the bottom section, the Southern Hemisphere forecast, you can see over time that the two have kind of converged in terms of the skills in our forecast has improved quite significantly. Of course, the skeptic of climate change that is saying, you people are talking climate change, but you are not speaking with one voice. Your models are giving different outputs. Different models are giving different outputs. There has been strides made in this regard. If you look at it, six models there, with regard to downscale precipitation over Africa using the six models. They are all in agreement with regard to areas that we experience high temperatures and low temperatures. There are no significant differences really. One other thing to worry about is the incidence of tropical cyclones from the Southwest Indian Ocean, which are the cyclones that have got an impact on us in South Africa. We've been very lucky over the past couple of years that tropical cyclones over the Indian Ocean have not hit us very hard over South Africa. They've impacted their fury over Madagascar and Mozambique. But the trend is showing there is an upward trend. And intensifying over time as shown by the diagram at the portfolio ACE index. We've got a database at the South African Weather Service, the National Climate Database, that dates back about 153 years since 1860, and we are analyzing data on the database to look at trends. Basically, this is what you see. The diagram, the top diagram on the left there is the usual. Observed the trend of climate change, shooting temperatures. For all stations, you can see your departures from the mean, your deviations from the mean of air temperatures are all above normal temperatures. Your precipitation trend is very, very patchy. Even your IPCC reports for the world are saying that there are very, very few countries where you've got coherence in your trend of precipitation. We have also developed scenarios for provinces in the country, for all provinces in the country. This one is for the Eastern Cape, for 2085, 2060, and 2035. And you can see the increasing trend for all those scenarios. Same with precipitation, and as I said before, precipitation is very, very catchy and incoherent. We've even gone to generate products for the SADC, as shown there in the summer mean. And you can see the positive values there over either Tanzania. That is as a result of the intensification of what we call the Indian dipole, residing heavier rainfalls over East Africa than Southern Africa. The star gram is perhaps depicting that in with more intensity. Then coming to conclusions and recommendations, we need accurate and geographically specific information for tourism destinations, for such areas as your coastlands, your game reserve and nature reserve. And for us, it's saying we need to intensify our data rescue efforts. We still have data dating back in the 1800s, which is seated in paper format, and we're trying to digitize that data so that it is easily available. At the moment, we cannot make those data available. That will support climate risk management and adaptation. We also need regionally and locally specific climate change scenarios. The scenarios that are projected there were scenarios that we generated at the South African Weather Service. We, however, need to build capacity in the region because, as we know, climate does not observe borders. We also need to research for multidisciplinary research teams for providers, users of climate information, or to understand climate decision-making context, to understand the effect of weather on customer satisfaction. I was speaking to the CEO of Cape Town Tourism, who was seated next to me there. Seems to be doing something very interesting to try to demystify the notion that Cape Town has got bad weather in winter and is using our weather information in order to demystify, to remove that myth. It's the kind of collaboration that we're looking for. The development of acceptable standards for specialized climate products for the industry in order to ensure consistent and accurate communication of climate information, facilitation of objective destination comparison, as well as effective partnerships. We also need to build capacity, both in the country and outside the country. We need to enhance our training efforts to service providers in the tourism sector, as well as to tourism professionals, including those in the hospitality industry. I would like to conclude this talk on a citation from Ken Smith in 1993, who said, meteorologists and tourist specialists rarely communicate with each other. So let's start to communicate. And communication is a two-way process. Let's start communicating. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Prof. It's a nice one. That further indicates that you are then saying you don't expect speculators and caregivers, but you don't want to find people looking but not seeing, as much as you don't want just to talk and people end up listening but not hearing. I think it's a time now that we engage on a discussion might also tie up to recommendations. Some recommendations will be tabled without listening, which then we consolidate at the end, because our key role as a portfolio committee, having listened and listened, also collated all the recommendations made. We are going to table our recommendations ultimately in the House, but I'm going to talk to what was contributed and further engage with other stakeholders regarding this. The floor is open. You start then, Mr. Shah.
Thank you, Chairperson. There's a lot that I can talk about. I would direct to the respective presenters, and hopefully, after applying our minds, we can come up with some answers. In terms of the national credit strategy, this is for the attention of Mr. Kidd. Then this relates to the implications of the Yamasutra declaration. I get the impression that there is a sense that this declaration is detrimental to our own aviation industry, and that's how it is being viewed. And there were various reasons that you gave to show that. But the bigger problem here is then, how are we going to connect the continent? Whatever tool do we have? We talk about the African Renaissance, we talk about increasing trade, promote trade and commerce within Africa to lower the price of traveling, and sometimes it's more like travel from here to Zimbabwe is more costly than buying a ticket from here to London and back. So how are we going to realize that African agenda when what was to be a well-intended initiative such as the Yamasutra initiative? So we will have to find some answers to that. Then to Mr. Aksa, you spoke about, you clarified what taxes were about, and the role of the treasury in that, and the regulated portion, non-regulated, and all of that. But you didn't talk about landing costs. We're regulated, because ultimately, whatever costs incurred by the airlines, they will seek to recover that from the travelers. So, what is it that determines your landing cost? Because from various presentations that we've had, from time to time, people did raise the issue of landing costs and how it is affecting, especially long-haul segments, especially the charter flights from our target country. Because they sometimes find it more convenient to land in Mozambique, for example, because it's cheaper to land there. Is it because the operating costs are high? And I understand our standards are high, our airports. But they will make no mistake about that. But still doesn't answer a question for tourism promotion, right? Because we can't afford a charter plane land in Mozambique and then bring people into a game park and bust them out back to Mozambique and they go and live there and spend money they wanted to spend here. So I'd like you to shed some light on why land costs. What is the denomination there? Mr. Arun, South African Airways, unlocking international regional element. Few questions here. The issue of domestic connectivity. I give you an example. I had to fly to Osaka, but I had to fly to Johannesburg to get to Osaka from Durban. Now, Durban, Osaka is a neighborhood here. So, what is it that determines? Is it simply volume? Travel volume, or what other considerations do you have? Because it doesn't tie in with what we're trying to achieve in terms of tourism, see? For example, you know, the route from Devon to Cape Town, I'm now flying British Airways after years of traveling on South African Airways. And the only reason I'm saying that is because you've downgraded the size of the plane. It's a small little plane in which I can't put my briefcase on the car on the top. Now, I know you don't fly a plane because of the size of my briefcase, one single person. But the point is, what was the consideration in England? The ferry made a route, Durban, Cape Town. So was it simply viability because of travel volume or whatever? Okay. You spoke about the reluctance of African states to implement open skies in South Africa. And you say that you have such agreements with other African states and, for that matter, non-African states such as the UAE. Now, what was it that... What did they consider when they did that? Why are they reluctant to have an agreement with us? Is it that they are afraid of us because we are big brother, or that we will swallow them up? What is it? You spoke about FAA, the lack of cohesion and formal working relationship with FAA tourism, and you indicate that you have some mitigation plan in place, such as a joint working group, and I suppose that has to do with planning and development. Now, where is that progress? What is the progress in terms of that envisaged? Is it envisaged or is it activated already? You correctly spoke about the issue of visa. I think this is something that we need to include in our recommendation very strongly, Because generally the visa regime is quite constraining, it is difficult, it is very not good. Turnaround time is bad, so then we need to get the DHA, the Department of Home Affairs here, and the Department of International Relations involved in this venture, because it's costing SA and it's costing tourism. Very quickly, Mr. Mango, Mr. Nico. Now, ignore my ignorance, excuse my ignorance here, okay? Now, what if that makes Mango low cost now? Or other airlines low cost? And that's the question. The differences in flight costs among the various the destinations between the mainstream airlines, and the low cost airlines. How do you make a price determination? Is it simply because you don't provide a bun or a little refreshment? If that is the case, then how do you swallow the vast difference in price between South African Airways on same route and a low-cost airline on the same route? If a low-cost price a ticket at a certain field from Durban to Joburg says 900 grand, and if you remove all the taxes, I mean, sometimes the cost of the taxes on the ticket shows more than the fuel price. So I'm like wondering, how do you make a profit there? And if it's simply because you keep it plain and simple. For me, the only simple thing I actually say is that you don't provide a gift. Now, that may be out of interest because taxes apply to you. I mean, you have to pay for landing, you have to pay for fuel, you have to pay for insurance, you have to pay for everything, the same as South African is. So the only thing is that you don't provide a gift. Is it the size of your operation or your operational costs that are involved that makes it like that? For me, I'm a layman, okay? So I need to understand what makes low-cost air flights, low-cost because the same sector as they fly, you are flying the same sector, and it's such a big change. I mean, that's the question for SAA then. If it is simply a price of 150 rand average, if you work out for a meal on the same sector, then how come Mango can afford to do a flight, but you have such an exorbitant flight on diamonds that pay 3,000 somewhere down from here to Johannesburg, when Mango could do it for less, a quarter of that. So maybe both need to give me an answer. And to Mr. Climate, and Professor Temba, have you done an audit on the carbon footprint of the general aviation industry in the country? A general audit of our carbon footprint. And for that matter, has South African Airways done its own audit to see what how soft or hard its footprint are? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I think I'm going to start maybe the first presentation from my brother, Kev. We noted it in the committee that deals with the issue of slot allocation. The most interested stakeholders are actually excluded there. I mean, that would be the tourism authorities and your trade and investment authorities. Because remember, we have regional aspirations as well. So we need to be take into consideration when some of the decisions are made, because they do have an impact. The one thing for sure is that if people can't get to your destination, then no one invests and no one can come and visit as a tourist. And therefore, we need to adopt a principle of equitable spatial development for the country. And therefore, there's a need to look at it. I also heard somewhere that South Africa is not a territory to the YD. I'm not sure if you can please clarify that, because it was mentioned by a very respectable gentleman when we had the World Development Forum. And obviously, the other issues are the opportunities that exist for the other, so say, two main gateways for the country, considering that the national airline has chosen one Tambo as a hub, because basically our only opportunity is to team up with foreign airlines so that you can develop services, and obviously that puts us in conflict with the policy that you're trying to promote. The other issue is that we find that from a long-haul point of view, maybe a half system works, but from a regional promotion point of view, point to point is always good, and I think it will be important therefore that when you look at it, that there should be a principle of multiple points of entry. I'll give an example of the work we're trying to do in Botswana. It takes a whole day from someone from Gaborone to try and get to Durban. When, if they were flying directly, it becomes a 1 hour 15 minute trip, And therefore,
if you then say to that person, you must fly to Johannesburg and then go connect, it just becomes an unstructure. The other point on maybe the South African Airways is that, you know, if you look at the, you know, the study of how the other sectors create a critical mass, you know, can, because I think it's probably about 10% of Africans have ever seen aeroplane. I think the same could be said 3 years ago about ESTV. But what did they do? They came up with the product, they spoke to the market, and, you know, and all this. Because you often hear people saying that the market is contracted, but it can't be contracted when there's only 10% of South Africans have ever been in aeroplane. So one mango did come in, but we feel they got just, you know, the idea of competing for the corporate market has got into them, and hence not seeing billboards in Soweto and townships trying to get more people to look at flying as an alternative to getting into a car, even though the price differential is actually very small. So we need to make flying a public transport. You know, we need to demystify this whole thing, but there's a lot of other issues. It's about how do you get to the airport, because these are all the issues that impact on this thing. I think, Honorable Chair, I just want to echo the press release that was issued by SAA when they withdrew between Durban and Cape Town. They said they have done an analysis and they found that it is a tourist route, therefore they can't fly. No. Yeah, I mean, that is what they said. So I'm not sure they're running tourism, but I'm sure they can actually explain it. Because it but we know that it was a hidden thing, because then that same plane was moved to Capon, and then instead of selling business class ticket for 4,000, it was selling business class ticket for 8,000, right? So it was an issue of yield thing. So, you know, that's basic issue, but I'm sure they can respond on that. As for Mango, the whole model of long or low cost carrier, I think maybe Nico, if he can just, I know there's a lot that's been spoken about that. And then the last thing, I want to check, you know, with my colleague Professor Dube, whether the new generation of aeroplanes that they're building, because he said we're going to be flying without seatbelts on, but are they being designed to also withstand the kind of weather? I mean, we were flying into Johannesburg 2 weeks ago. Firstly, we hit a terrible airport, but as we were coming to land, the pilot said the wind is 90 kilometers, the plane is designed to withstand 50 kilometers wind. Now, it's a very scary thought, you know, so that is the one thing. And then from AXA, we know that the airports on average, they operated about 70% of the capacity, but we indicated 42 billion rand capital investment over the next 5 years. Do they have a plan for mass margin? The existing capacity in terms of you know, the gateways before they start embarking on this, or are they going to leave the other airports that are operating at high capacity and then continue to expand their capacity? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hi, Chair. Paul Banster. A couple of issues which are more holistic rather than addressed to an individual. And the one really is this debate of ownership and mandate. And the issue of SAA, and I'm using as a comparison here the Emirates-Dubai model, which is where everything is really predicated on maximizing access and egress through Dubai, make people spend time there. Their airlines, their airports work together to do that. They're not actually about making money. They're about the economic benefits coming to the country itself. Now, I've never seen clarity on SAA's actual mandate. Is it in fact to maximize access and egress? Or is it to be a commercial airline? And until one gets that clear, I think you're not even going to get out starting to talk. Secondly, the same thing is true of AXA. I'm intrigued to learn of AXA's global aspiration. I think it's brilliant. But I would love a situation where AXA agreed, well, okay, we'll make our profit in Brazil and India, and we'll work at break-even in South Africa because we want to maximize access and egress. I know it's radical, but it's the sort of thing to improve our competitiveness as well. So question number one. Question number two. The competitive threat of Victoria Falls emerging as a regional leisure hub is really quite significant. If you just put your geography app on, and if you almost treat Southern Africa like a delta, and you see a hub point of Vic Falls, you can reach everywhere out of Vic Falls. It's a very real possibility that during the not too foreseeable future, Vic Falls could take a lot of the hub traffic out of OOT. And I think that's something we need to think about, where OLP might become more of a domestic and a business leisure, sorry, a business hub. The third point would be about the roles. Again, this is a sensitive issue to raise, but everything with regards to actor, and I don't mean to be sort of critical in any way, but fails actor. So, for example, if a car train links to ORT, there is no public transport of substance going to Lanseria. Johannesburg needs a powerful second airport, and it needs to have equal opportunity access to that. You don't want to end up with a Heathrow model, where Gatwick is a very poor neighbour and doesn't have its access going into it. And my final point is really an interesting debate, and I think Nico has actually left the room, but since the departure of One Line, the price creep of low-cost airlines has been quite dramatic. And I can't blame them for taking that margin back, but the fact is they're not achieving the mandate they originally set out, which is to make more people fly than ever flew before. And I find the latest moves to block new members coming into the market rather anti-competitive in the way that it's been treated. So, again, none of these are necessarily specific questions, but they are issues which I believe require debate if we're going to increase our competitiveness as a tourism destination. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sponsor?
Thank you, Chair. I think what you are trying to throw is that the objectives of Yamasuku's decision is not being realized, because countries, those that are of interest, particularly to South Africa, are not interested in giving us the Yamasuku Declaration, even if they give us the bilateral and the conditions around it. So yes, we are highlighting that point. For instance, when you said that Mali has agreed, and there are other flights in South Africa and Mali, or the other smaller countries, they are able to do that, but the other countries where it matters most, they do not. If you look at part of what you want to achieve, is to support the entity and strategy of South African Airways. And if, for instance, they are focused on the African continent, it means we need to engage the people that they increase the African continent, but in most instances it is very difficult to access those markets. So basically we are in support of your Yamasuku Declaration, and I think South Africa team is a signatory to your Yamasuku Declaration, because out of Yamasuku, there's a phrase in that decision that any other country would buy a letter become signatory to Yamasuku if they didn't. South Africa is, that's why there's quite a number of those arguments with other countries. And then maybe to make some comments on some other issues. An issue that is not being mentioned here are some things.
Just one little thing. There is something that you said about the exiting agency. What's the problem? Because it said it's not in Kenya yet.
That structure should be established by AU and AFAC. It has not been established. So it would be a watchdog. An implementing mechanism. For instance, if we have problems with certain countries, we have to approach that agency and say, please, can you get us together with this country? We're not interested in a bilateral, but a white team. So it's not in existence. It's supposed to be established by AFCON. It's not in the list of things that they want to do immediately. The issue of the airports, I'm mentalized airports, one of them is on Tata, Mashike, etc., etc. There was a view that AXA should take over those airports, that's one. But they need revival for AXA to take them over. Unfortunately, this brings us to the issue of a mandate which has been used. What's the mandate of AXA? In the mandate of AXA, I think AXA is very clear. Be viable, let's put it that way. Be a viable entity, and where the business opportunities go for them. And also AXA mandate is to then venture into African continent to try and initiate infrastructure development, because as you know, our president is the chair leading the infrastructure development for the continent. So that's where we have a problem. So the question is, we tackle together. The numbers would come. That's the problem. You would realize that the department relaunched on Tata Airport, that they were able to land bigger aircraft there. But ending this flight is more like us because they make the necessary load factors to bring it to not be profitable. They bring it to one and then there's a problem. And this is the problem that African Air faces, where choices for routes, whether you fly to Beijing, to Hong Kong, which you choose to take. But the issue of the media comes in, again, in terms of them going forward. The issue of generalization, I think we're in a better position to measure carbon footprint for the major airports, particularly Accra control airports and the secondary airports. We've got the infrastructure to be able to do that. Generalization, the problem is that 1,360 small landing strips throughout the country were generalization. So the problem is, how do you measure that? But we're trying to have a lens to address that. The question from point to point, I think that if you're a flying passenger, you'd want to move from Gaborone to Durban instead of Gaborone, Johannesburg, Durban. My personal view is that we need to get Accra to market Kinshasa International Airport, because it seems it's an effort of KZN that markets the airport, and Accra doesn't seem to be marketing. Or let's say not Accra, Accra Kinshasa. The people that are running that airport, there's very little that we've seen that tries to market that airport. US airport does more work in that direction than what Accra is doing. Maybe it's a question of strategy. They need to choose whether they make or tier more successful so that it subsidizes, or they split the resources. It's the choice that they make. The third condition, is not a problem with including yourself and any other stakeholder in the process of allocating slots. It's within the Department of Transport, it's something that can do, I think. The price, yes, I would agree. We made a snapshot of Fuzzy after the one time had applied for Becker. We found that the prices of the trip from Johannesburg to Cape Town, it almost was 3 times what it was when one time it was on board. And obviously those opportunities, if you're in that space yourself, you take an opportunity that there's a demand, and if there's a demand, the consequences to demand. But we hope that if there's more players coming into the picture, and then the prices may go down. But what is missing in terms of local area? The original plan was to get the other people on the fly to fly. But there's very little market activity in those areas. People are not approaching somebody in Garissa and say to them, look, if you drive to them, if you fly one time or you fly nine, it would be even cheaper to do that. There could be other complications of connection from the airport and getting to wherever you're going. But you're not marketing that and saying to people, there's available public transport that can be that type of thing. Maybe the question could be the relaunch of Santiago Air. It means that's our problem. Thanks, Chair. I think I've got to do it.
Anyone
want to
take a take on the question?
Thank you, Chairperson. If I can just respond to some of the questions that are understood to be relevant, particularly to the after presentation. The first one regarding the land cost, I think that's reality. Just maybe one step back, Chair, the whole philosophy of Mr. Twala spoke of the management. When the company was vested 20 years ago, in fact, I was fortunate to be part of that first journey, and I recall that first year before we started, we still were subsidized by government just short of 100 million. And at that time, the approach was one to say, on a sustainability level, we want to try and take a lot of the pressure off the aviation component. So at that stage, we were probably running on an 80-20% ratio, 20% in commercial revenues and 80% dependent on tariff for either landing fees, passenger charges, etc. So over time, we've moved to create more balance in that, and by doing so, take pressure off the charges. So when we talk about tariffs, and when we talk about tariffs going forward also, the percentages that were quoted, they are on the departure side for departing passengers, which is the airport component for passengers, and there are the charges that are in the presentation. For the arriving aircraft, there's also landing fees. In fact, there's also a parking fee if you exceed a certain number of hours on the airport apron. We try and promote a situation where your aircraft will move faster through, and in doing so create more capacity. Those tariffs are commensurate with the percentages that we saw, and that is a cost directly by the airline. Obviously, I think the honourable member was making the point that that's still a cost in the total system. There are no different percentages, so I think the main thrust of the presentation was to show that whether you're an airline or a passenger, over the next five to 10 years, we're looking at low and in fact at zero entry tariffs, on the basis of obviously a number of assumptions. The one critical issue that we need to do in terms of growth is to understand what economies are going to do and what type of pressures they would put for expansion. It might be that the growth is so slow that there will be none of that project capacity, money spent for capacity projects, because as rightfully indicated, there's still some capacity left at the airport. I just want to say to the honourable member in front of me here, my dear good colleague, Zabu, that a big focus of ours is not just to build and create more, but also to optimize. So the one issue that I spoke of in terms of, for example, managing on-time performance, that is but one example. There are various other initiatives where we look at using the current capacity best. So what we've done is we've created industrial engineering capability within our business, and they constantly look at flows, process management, capacity management. We look at how we can take one piece of infrastructure and get the best utilization out of that capacity, to the point that we could then further improve on the initial design capacity. I must say technology also helps us a lot in that regard, because you would find, and I'll use a practical example, we typically, when we commission the new airport terminal in Cape Town, we provide exactly the same number of checking counters that we used to have. And the reason for that is we brought in a new dynamic, which was the cell tower service. So by starting to bring new technology, you actually take a lot of pressure off building and building. So technology, whether you sell out through a kiosk or whether you actually do it from home, is also assisting us in managing and optimizing our capacities. Chief, I'm just reflecting on the one point of talking about the international strategy and what benefit that should have at a local level. I think it is a good point. I think it's a valid point. At this stage, where we are with industry, obviously going into these environments do represent some level of risk. And it's, well, maybe not early days. You think we've been in Mumbai now for 4 or 5 years, but it is still early days for us as an organization in terms of moving in the international arena. And what the local fraternity and industry have said to us, that they're not at this stage keen to attract any risk that is not, or international risk. And obviously on that basis, then if there is any upside at this stage, it falls outside of that framework. Where we will go with that in future, I think, is probably an interesting consideration as we strengthen the international, because that's one of the reasons why we are doing it, is wanting to be able to spread on a more be able to have broader base, and ultimately then allow for the opportunity for diversification, and in doing so strengthen the overall business model. Where we will go in terms of regulations, how the shareholder would view this going forward, how the shareholder might want to incentivize the company to further and more strongly pursue the strategy, I think that will also be determining the time. I think the commitment we have now made to the shareholder and to industry is that these ventures that we have taken on, we have to make sure that we make a success out of them. And I must say, these are not lightweight projects. The one in Brazil, next year they have the World Cup. They're feverishly finishing facilities and constructing, and they still have commission. So these projects are big and they're high profile, and obviously the brand is out there. So for us, it's very important to focus right now in making sure that we properly execute our duties and represent the brand. As far as airports, and maybe the need for skin airport accounting, I know that there are two international licenses, I think the rest of the provinces have one. And how that over time, every airport at some time will reach capacity. But we do know that these airports are long term, and they have to be informed by a national plan as to the whole issue that Mr. Twala spoke about liability. We cannot venture into these initiatives if we are not confident and sure that they are informed by appropriate policy and that there is sustainability. They are very good examples, Chair, and unfortunately that's the reality internationally of airports that were built and then closed. There are examples of airports that were built and 3 years after being completed, they still haven't been commissioned. We haven't been in that space. I don't think we intend being in that space, and obviously for us, it will be very important to work with all of our stakeholders to make sure what we do in a way that we all would want to see happening. Chair, I hope I've covered all of the questions.
Is there another hand? Let me start with you and you'll be the last day.
Prof.
Just finish up today.
Thank you, Chair. I have a friendly question to Mr. Twala. I'm going back to the Yamadu crude declaration. If you look at the Africa end market to South Africa, it grew exponentially. And if you look at the objective of the declaration, which is not being realized, if that can be realized, that is going to result in an explosion of travel, especially among the African countries. So the Africa air market is going to explode, and that is going to be good news for tourism, notwithstanding the issues of responsible tourism, etc. But as a tourism activist, I'm looking at the tourism interest for now. But the problem is the declaration, the objective, the main objective of the declaration is not being realized. Now my question is, can we review the declaration? Can we renegotiate the declaration? I know it's difficult to renegotiate history, but it's possible. And secondly, who should make sure, or who should ensure that the objective of the declaration is realized for the benefit of Africa? It seems to be like no one takes responsibility to initiate, to confront the challenge that the declaration has with regard to tourism growth. But the question is, who should make sure that happens? And can we review, if something does not work, why keep it? Why not change it heavy? Thank you, sir.
Just before you answer that question,
thank you, Chair. I think there were two questions that were directed to me. The one was on whether we have done an audit of carbon footprint for the aviation industry. Yes, there are estimates of emissions that are issued by the Department of Environmental Affairs, per IPCC sectors. There are 7 sectors in the IPCC, your energy, transport, industry, forestry, agriculture, residential and commercial buildings, and waste. They are categorized, and aviation is included under transport, which is set in terms of contribution to the total, transport comes there in terms of emissions. The honorable member of the portfolio committee would be glad to know that we are developing the South African Air Quality Information System, known as the SAQIS, which is a step forward in updating those estimates of emissions. The South African Weather Service amendment bill is currently in Parliament in order to extend the mandate of SALT from climate and weather into air quality, assisting the Department of Environmental Affairs, which is our mother department, in executing its duty in as far as air quality management is concerned. We are not only limited to the emissions, we are already fully fledged with the ambient module of FO2, sulfur dioxide, nitrous dioxide. We already have a database, and we know we already have something like 100 industries and municipalities that are reporting on the surface. The next phase will be air quality modeling. It's a very exciting phase, air quality modeling and forecasting. We'll be able, like our developed counterparts in Europe,
I will be able to issue, just like we issue weather warnings, we'll be able in the near future to issue air quality warnings. The second question was on the design of aeroplanes. I think it was coming from the CEO of KZN Tourism, if I'm not mistaken. My belief is that mitigation policy could be through technology, which is what I think was emphasizing, market mechanisms and tourist behavior. The design of aeroplanes, in my opinion, because projections are indicating that the weather is not going to be normal anymore. It's not going to be business as usual. My take on this one would be just like it has happened with the building industry, NHBRC has come up with building codes for different parts of the country. If you require an energy certificate now, if you're building. But this one, the design of aeroplanes, I think it's something for perhaps the Department of Agriculture, of Transport, to take through international fora, such as your ICAO, or even your Department of Tourism through the UNWTO, because it is a mitigation aspect, and it needs to be done at that level, at an international level. I thank you, Chair.
The house is surely getting invaded. What happens? But I will take you, the sponsor, no more questions. You and then the last day.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. It is possible to review YT as it stands. The Ministers of Transport of African Continent can do that, or it can come from OEU, or AU now. It depends on what people who are trying to do. If they regard it as a challenge that needs to be addressed, I think they do that. It is on the agenda of the Ministers of Transport meeting in October, decided. So hopefully something will come out of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there were about 4 or 5 questions directed at SAA, and some of them have been answered in the dialogue so far. Let me maybe try and summarize in the interest of time. There was a question regarding the domestic connectivity. Why do we not fly from Durban to Mthatha and you have to go back to Johannesburg? Indeed, it would be in our interest to make sure that we connect every point in the country. But the reality is the density of the demand. If there's demand, then definitely we'll employ the aircraft. But we must also understand that another question says, what is the mandate of South African Airways? More than anything else, we are mandated to be a profitable organization. So if the density on a particular route does not warrant a profitable operation, we will not operate. However, earlier on in my presentation, I spoke about the all-of-state approach, where we then have Bango, South African Express, and South African Airways under one umbrella. The aircraft that we operate are all different aircraft. So, for example, SAA Express would then be best suited to operate those routes that are low, that are small, but with a demand that satisfies the small aircraft that they have. The second question was the point-to-point versus the hub strategy coming from KZN Tourism. And yes, indeed, that's a very valid observation. Why would someone want to come from Gaborone via Johannesburg to Durban? However, if you look at the economics of the operation, 1.2 million in Gabon, in Botswana, how many of those people are actually going to be traveling on holiday in and how many of those people will be traveling at what regularity? Those are the kind of considerations we take into place when we are developing the route. We want to make sure that our sister company, SAA Express, would evaluate that opportunity. That's why we support fully their initiatives to operate from Durban to Harare, from Durban to Lusaka. They are already making a lot of traction, and we support them all the way, because we believe that there are some routes that we are not interested to operate. Our aircraft are too big for those routes. The contentious issue of Durban Cape Town, I'm sorry to say it, but there's quite a lot of anecdotal discussion around the decision, why did we do this? The only reason that we withdrew was because we were pleading. We were not making money on that one, simple and straightforward. Did we make the right decision in terms of getting into an agreement with Mango to deploy a solar aircraft? Maybe that's not that wasn't the decision. But under those circumstances, under that particular issue, not being profitable, we had to make a decision and we had to live with it. We regret that decision was not communicated from start to finish. We actually regret and apologize for that. But however, we have to make a decision because we have to make sure to live by the mandate of our shareholders. There was a question of saying, how do we then evaluate the mandate of SA? Are we meeting mandate? When you compare Emirates and Dubai, again, yes, that's a very valid observation. But once you look at it from a strategic point of view, that's why in our long-term turnaround strategy, we are saying we are going to go to all the stakeholders and make sure that everybody understands fully what are the implications of the decisions that we've made from a domestic, regional, and international point of view. There are markets on the international sectors that are operating right now, which are very strategic to the country. They might not necessarily be making money for South African Airways. We have to come and message that through to you as our stakeholders, so that we can all understand and agree on the way forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm very sorry, but I will take you when we are in the next session just to listen to the issues that you intended to. Were you intending to hold the question? Can you then quickly, can you hold that question? I feel very much uncomfortable because I want everybody to feel that he has participated, even though that I get us to create the occasion.
Good afternoon, Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. The question that I really want to comment and a question that I wanted to pose is when we talk about the National Air Strategy, we talk about the Human Footprint Declaration, we talk around SAA. There's a whole bunch more that is involved in this equation. And the question that I wanted to ask D.D. Twala really refers to sort of Cape Town International and Sharjah International. What are the opportunities of us getting other flights from there? And from a Western Cape point of view, Cape Town International, in the next 2-3 years, there's going to be a huge requirement from oil and gas and retail sector to be flying to Luanda, Lusaka, Accra. We have an opportunity to bring in some American airlines from Miami and also direct flights in potentially in from Brazil and flying in from Guarulho or Rio de Janeiro. Those rights are also part of a much broader airline strategy. It doesn't seem to make sense to me that you have 2 provincial airports that are international and strong. I mean, the Clusia over here has received the award 3 years in a row for the best airport in Africa. Yet outside of the Yamakutsa, Yama, the YE, etc., there's still huge opportunities for us to fly the airline if that's part of the national airlift strategy. Thank you for your indulgence, Chair.
What's your
question? The question here. If there is that expansion, I think the license is to do that. And we're not saying, as a department, if people apply to fly to any destination, if it's international airport, you allow them. We do not charge them to any direction. We do not. If they find that there's business case for to fly in Kinshasa, yes. If, for instance, to Cape Town International Airport, yes, they don't be able to do that. I think we'll support such initiative.
Further remarks? I think we've come to the end of our session. And, well, what is so important here? Issues are not cutting. And it demands that the department, intergovernmental and intergovernmental, the intergovernmental and the interdepartmental relations must be strengthened. We spoke about the Maputo Declaration. Yes, it is moving, but it still needs to be further against. Further from we have the honorable Professor Zanazuma in the AU. I think some of the issues should be influenced from our region. It's so important. I'm talking about Sadiq in this particular instance. The other thing, we as a portfolio committee will be also linking with our sister portfolio committees to further engage on specific issues that are not our mandate, so that we can find a common ground in dealing with the issues. Yes, I did ask you during recess about ministers' meeting. and putting their heads together regarding all the issues that we have discussed. Yet they indicated that I'm talking about regional and African ministers, that is why I raised the name of Kodavana so much in such a point. To them, it is that heaven. Because we as well as we do in the oversight. We listen carefully, then we make the final recommendation at the end of the day. What is important is the maturity of the United States building a country. So it's important that we always find a common ground when we do that. The bilaterals are so essential and important. I remember we spoke at the Indaba to them, it is essential, it is important, rather than begin to point fingers. So it is important that we don't begin to create territorial and marking the territory. It's to find one another so that we are able to achieve a key objective and they are highlighted in our national human plan. Possession is a chance.
Committing to should be getting ready and proceeding through. It's time to time, but just be brief, and we want recommendation. We want the reason.
Thanks, Tim. I'm just going to highlight what the commission discussed and these are the items. The commission agreed that it is very interesting that the UNESCO declaration does not really fulfill, does not achieve into and that will now exclude bilateral in other countries where the local operating procedures are dropped and to operate from, and that will also lead to further engagement to hire for the second aid to try and resolve the issues that arise from that. And they also outline that the black office is keeping an entity of the YD, and that the abolition of this is a serious challenge, like for instance what is happening now between South and Tanzania, which is going on to bring in an international operator, but operating in Tanzania and subsequently flagging other countries like South Africa using the YD. So those are the challenges that have been faced, and that is the need to solve those kind of issues through a particular body that might create it in the YD. There is also a poor connectivity in the continent that was highlighted as well, that there is a need to look at the way to make travel easier and cheaper and less energy intensive. One of the things that was made was the issue of traveling to Tunisia, whereby if you want to travel to Tunisia, you would have to go by far to Tunisia, find people and then continue to Tunisia. There were issues also raised with regards to policies for the countries that open space for competition. There is issues of coercive and complementary planning that involves all stakeholders, like for instance if the Department of Transport has to come with a particular policy, has to interact with AXA and also SAA in order to get the insights in what is happening in the industry, as well as the Department of Tourism on what the strategy is and going forward, so that whatever policy is developed from there does not hinder growth in tourism and development. And that is also in the different sectors in terms of climate change as well. The climate change policies should also address certain issues in transport and not detrimental to flying to other countries and so forth. There was an issue that was certainly raised of visas, that the turnaround time for visas is the first challenge for tourists, and also the transit visas. The process of getting transit visas and the cost are very much the growth of tourism, and that in most instances people will look for alternatives whereby they would not require transit visas, and that would make traveling much easier. Issue of transformation is also raised, and that is a need for transformation, and all the things that were raised by the different presenters like from SAA, AXA, that transformation is in the agenda and that is things that they would want to address. There's also an issue of trying to encourage new entrants so that we improve competition in the sector in order to make traveling costs cheaper and also promote tourism. There was also an issue of raising or strengthening the South-South relations and coming up with a hub strategy that will access growth in the industry, and also that we need to develop tourism products in order to get into new markets. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does anyone need any clarification? The Yamasuk Group Declaration is a contract between African countries about flight from one country to another country. Is that the true understanding? From one country to another country, the Yamasuk Group Declaration. It's an agreement between African countries on regulating flights in Africa.
Okay. We have discussed that in literature. And that particular agreement, there were strong feelings that it has to be looked into. We have then agreed that we are still going to interrogate that so that we can find a common ground and understanding regarding the political situation.
No, you see, sometimes we take it for granted that because we know these terms, other people know these terms. I think we're verified now.
Thank you, Justice. I'll just through the other recommendations towards the end, but also there are some highlights that emanated from another presentation that we captured. So there was a discussion about the importance of development finance institutions to work closely with destinations to ensure destination competitiveness. We had IGC and DBSA, so they talk a lot about that. Stakeholders to work towards a target of travel among South Africans. Destinations need to develop demand-driven products that take into consideration They identified domestic market segment liberalization by a professor from the University of Pretoria about the issue of how do you match the gender model that they have developed that matches demand and supply. So definitely it has to be customized elsewhere in the hand, so there is a need to look at then developing products that are demand driven. Institutions of higher learning need to work closely with entities to conduct better research that will promote domestic tourism. Studies that have been commissioned and conducted by various universities need to be shared with all stakeholders and destinations encouraged to customize them in their localities. Destinations need to investigate and develop niche tourism products, diversify local tourism, and the commission had a discussion around health tourism and your health staff that can develop as one of the niche markets in the country. Destinations need to explore development of comprehensive tourism routes to involve local communities, especially pre-diabetes and other communities. There were a lot of discussions around this in terms of what makes and breaks tourism routes and the comprehensive necessity of planning, therefore involving disadvantaged communities was added too. The role of tourist guides needs to be fully integrated into tourism route development. National health strategy has already been developed and is looked at integrating the art, the heritage and cultural aspects. And this one deals with aspects in the site that need to be declared, because Safari said that there are many of these throughout the country, and the process of declaring them was discussed, but also now there is a need for entrepreneurs to look at this as to how they can leverage on these cultural heritage sites. That important was placed on ensuring that you protect the status of these heritage sites as you develop tourism products. And also with ICC, they shared with us the trend that most of the hotels have been closed down, but while hotels have been closing down, it has bottomed up with those low occupancies, and that's something that needs to be looked at very closely and cautiously, because the trend in terms of those who are interested in investing in the tourism plan. And also ICC made that they are prepared to assist. I think I'm running out of battery. It's been a long day. And also there is an undertaking that has been taken to consolidate a number of funding institutions. There is an institution now called CIFA, and that institution can assist in terms of supporting SMME funding. And there was an issue about also downgrading the forecast because the forecast that was done for 2017, but it has been downgraded looking at the current house expenditure, fixed investment and expenditure on services, which will be your hospitality and accommodation. And that the low interest rate may remain low until 2014, and for those who want to invest, it's a short window period that can be exploited. A business case can be made for those. And also the aim of service in terms of promoting domestic tourism was alleged to say one of the major issues that the industry needs to deal with to promote domestic tourism. I think some of this were dealt with by the first commission, but also there was an issue of handling local knowledge, tourism, road development, and the issue of maintenance of this very site was important, and the call that was made yesterday here by the DG was also made that maybe we have to look at investigating the pros and cons of introducing a national heritage to the name. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Kurbalo. Any explanation from here? No. Okay, the next commission, number 3, on transformation.
Good afternoon to everyone. I trust that my battery will not disappoint me because it's also at 10 to 20%. Our commission, commission number 3, was tasked to look at tourism transformation. I will just go through what I tried to capture and the members of the commission in case there are some points that are not well presented, they will highlight or explain or give the correct perspective. The commission looked at a number of issues. The first issue was the state of tourism transmission in South Africa, and also it looked at empowering small, medium and micro enterprises, and it also looked at the role of unions in tourism industry in South Africa. And it also looked at the private sector perspective on MDP and tourism and tourism development. And also it looked at a case of successful emerging tourism, the one that we have seen just now presented. And also we looked at the private sector perspective on MDP tourism. And what we have observed in the commission, we observe that the tourism sector in the context of NDP requires more serious leadership and effort from the national department, especially in coordinating and ensuring the intergovernmental dynamic and various concurrencies in the funding that should be brought to the central stage. And we also noted that the current intergovernmental relations are very weak in the sector, and so there are a lot of challenges which negatively impact on the design of an appropriate intergovernmental financing arrangement for the sector. Hence, we made some recommendations. The commission, there is also a commission that is currently engaged in initial stage of reviewing the intergovernmental fiscal system, and it would be useful for the department to engage with the process. One of the members of the commission is directly involved in this commission. And then it was recommended that we need to find another name for small tourism business sector, moving away from moms and pops and use emerging business, use the word emerging small business rather than saying small businesses. There is a need to mobilize youth development programs in the tourism industry. And also the commission recommends that a gender split for small accommodation and establishment management levels for the age 52 male female should also be considered. And the commission further recommended that there is a need to grow the business so that at least they can employ more people. And also the framework, the PPP framework should then bring other partners, corporate and industries, such as financial services, communication, and retail. And also there was a need to look at the funding model for MMEs development, that it should be well defined and planted, who does what, how, and etc. And the commission further recommended that there is a need to explore the ways to close a gap between emerging and large entities. And also there's the need for monitoring and evaluation for entities participating in the enterprise development. And there was also a need to start to talk about the transformation in the past. It was noted that there was no presentation that is looking at how people can participate in the past as part of the and the commission also recommended that there is a need to strengthen business linkages for SME through market access. Then I think that's all in a nutshell.
Are there any additions or amendments? There seems to be none, but I think on this provincial part, it was said that because of land restitution, communities are often having opportunities to migrate into the provincial park. And then the department has to find the means of support if those emerging businesses had a case after evaluation. They either when they had possessions or something that made them to be viable. The issue of rooms, apparently there were the general average of workers per room was estimated by a business person to be one room, one person. And it was proposed that we've got to find means to try and work around that ratio with the necessary support from the government in an effort to increase this thing of employment. I think that was one of the points in the commission. And then from DBSA, there was the issue of the cost of doing business was high. Given some rates in the municipal government and other inputs that the government had a control on, we've got to consider managing those costs because many businesses could not grow. Instead, they became broke and then could not operate anymore. I think that was the point. If I'm not correct, that was the tourism council of South Africa. And those were some of the things that I would think. Are there any other points? But the case we've got to make is that entrepreneurship needs to be inspired. Entrepreneurship needs to be supported. because it can make a difference in terms of employment. But it does not mean that that is the responsibility of the department. It is everybody's responsibility for wherever we are, whether we are in the media or wherever we are, to inspire people to develop into entrepreneurs. The more entrepreneurs we have, then the more job opportunities we would have. So those were the remarks, and then in that route, then transformation plans would be improved. In effect, that was what was discussed, and I do not know whether the resolutions are ready yet. If they are not ready, let them be changed if they are ready. In terms of process, the parliament is going to develop a report. We shall debate the report in parliament. And then secondly, the report is going to be circulated to each and every participant here, together with a directory of each and everyone who is here, for purposes of networking. With conduct and email addresses. And secondly, when time for lunch comes, we shall be having a buffet just outside here, there in the dining hall next to this room. Just the other side of the screen, it's a dining hall. So we shall be having our lunch there immediately after we finish drawing up our resolutions, reading our resolutions. But if perhaps there is a feeling that there is an inaccuracy somewhere, let us correct that inaccuracy whilst we are still working.
Thank you, Chairperson. We tried among the two of us to consolidate the commission. The resolution in terms of the recommendations that are coming from different commissions. We'll just read through them. The first one, the Department of Agriculture to work together with the National Department of Tourism Investigating Feasibility to offer different charging regimes for citizens and international tourists visiting cultural and heritage tourism attractions. The second was South African Tourism and Department of Arts and Culture to explore joint market ventures for cultural and heritage attractions. NDC Arts and Culture, Transport and Cooperative Governments to have joint planning, educational strategy and policy level in issues of common interest. Fourth, Department of Tourism to explore the cooperative governments assisting authorities to establish coordinating structures. The Parliament to look into differentiated but equal development in terms of restrictions forced by carbon footprint regime in responding to the European Union Emission Trading System, that is in terms of the carbon taxes as well as discussed in aviation working group. Parliament to engage the African Union interested in other African countries to ratify the Arusha Declaration and those countries that have already ratified to implement commitments made to the declaration. Local alliance weight loss believes this nation to stimulate tourism packages that promote domestic tourism and address geographical spread. Enhance collaboration among various government departments in the form of implementation protocols and memorandum of understanding to create conducive environment for tourism growth. Stakeholders to collaborate developing affordable packages to promote domestic tourism. And promoting public travel among South Africans. Innovative work to bring destinations to work towards matching product offerings with demand of the identified market segments in South Africa. Destinations have therefore possibilities of establishing comprehensive tourism routes to promote local and rural tourism based on available research. Destinations to work closely with development finance institutions to package high impact projects to facilitate investment in the sector. I think here in light of FIFA also the SMMEs. Parliament to engage national treasury in motivating for more funding for tourism growth and to intensify collaboration with institutions of higher learning and further tourism research, development and innovation. And it is to share the results of the visa to ensure that to ascertain if there needs to another study needs to be conducted to ensure that the tourism visa the instrument has been able to drive transformation in the sector. State of government to develop joint programs for capacity building for municipalities, your tourism officials, for their partnership with SALGA. Was noted even yesterday. Also, to investigate merits and demerits of imposing a national heritage levy on tourism and cultural assets. Thank you.
Are we comfortable with all the resolutions? Or perhaps do we believe that we need some amendments? Mr. Shah?
Thank you, Chair. I think there isn't a balance, you know, between the outcomes of each commission which is captured in the ultimate draft resolution. I think we need to look at the various feedbacks that we received from the three commissions and ensure that they are reflected in some way in the draft resolution. That's the first thing. The other difficulty I'm having in this process is we haven't really had an opportunity to apply our minds to this resolution that we are about to adopt. Because we must bear in mind that being a cross-cutting sector, it's an impact on other departments in some way. And perhaps, I don't know what the solution is, but I think perhaps what we should do, which might be, against protocol, is perhaps to entertain, we have entertained feedback, perhaps give the committee time to consolidate all the inputs and all the issues that were raised, and then formulate a set of recommendations after having seriously applied our mind. Now, I know that that doesn't sound very much in line with the protocol, but I'm afraid that that might not.
But in your view, the broadly, it should capture some of the things. Mr. Kora.
Not in our way. I was just wanted to support the motion from the honorable chair.
Let me briefly. Broadly, we accept the broad thrust of the resolution. And we do accept that we cannot resolve on behalf of everybody, but we can recommend that these things happen. I think do we accept that? Is that in line with the rules there? Okay. And Mr. Khan?
Chair, I didn't know that Floyd was procedurally correct in retrospect. We adopt resolution with the proviso stating that it's not, that there is still room for further development of it. In other words, should we, subsequently, for example, I find that the issue of fairness strategy hasn't been adequately addressed yet. So we make that proviso, somebody later should say, for example, we recommended that we should encourage competition in the low-cost industry, airline industry. Now, when we make that recommendation, somebody shouldn't argue, well, it wasn't in the resolution, how dare you do such a thing. So I think we need to put in a proviso with faith that this is just the broad capturing and not the detail, and that there's a possibility that there could be additions.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Mr. Shah. But surely there must have been a case for low-cost airlines. It made it there. The price of traveling, particularly by airline.
The only reference to low-cost chair is to work closely with the provinces to stimulate tourism packages. But that doesn't quite capture the issue of domestic connectivity and role of low-cost airlines.
Okay.
And the possibility of encouraging new entrants as well as competition in order to lower the cost of flying so that more people could fly. If it doesn't touch it.
Okay. Then we go to, for instance, the complaint of the traveling from Johannesburg to Kimberley was much more expensive than traveling from Johannesburg to Cape Town again. And then they were saying that despite the fact that the distances were shorter. And the same applies to other smaller towns. And then the point, I don't know how you discussed it, I was not in that committee. Commission. I don't know whether you can help us with the clue.
Maybe not on that one, Chair. I just also wanted to highlight, just to support the motion, there was a strong point on transit visas and the impact it has. So I suspect there are maybe one or two points that will probably need to be added.
Okay, let us do this. Let us invite a written submission for about a week. Is that okay with you, Jerry? For about 7 days. And then beyond that, sit down and finalize the resolution. Would that be okay? Because perhaps some of the participants could feel that they were hard done by. Do we agree on that?
Thanks, sir. We can do that as a committee. If there are people who still want to make some other input to what this meeting has developed, but ultimately, the report itself of the project of this, it has to go through to the National Assembly. So in our case, as a committee, we will put our product as a recommendation to the National Assembly. Then thereafter, the National Assembly will take a resolution to adopt those recommendations that have come all from a number of people who are here. So that is what it's a parliamentary process that the outcome of this will follow. So if there are any other things that may still be coming, then we can still do that and allow people and give them some time to make those additional inputs if there are any that are still outstanding. Because the other issue is that we should not lose sight of, some departments might be implicated by these recommendations or resolutions. And yet they did not even participate here. So
That's also the other thing that we need to take into account. Hence, when we send the report to the National Assembly, it will be in the form of recommendation. It's only the Parliament that will take a decision and make them resolution. Thank you.
Mr. Faro, I think what we've got in front of us here is a board-based document which reflects some of the things. I mean, if we talk into the issues of job opportunity and employment, I mean, one could then take the inputs that were done by the PPI and the SIDs and look at that as an infrastructural opportunity for the creation of microtourism out of the, let's say, the Woodward Dam. And those details, I think, is something that we have to roll out in terms of our processes from here onwards. But doesn't it change the face of what has been put forward here? It's in the broad sense in there, and we just need to capture some of the detail as to how in it. And I think Jerry is quite right in the process, and I think that we should be now left to our resources to sit down with the committee and be able to actually then just unpack what we have as a broad outline and detail it in terms of the way forward, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we do agree there, because it is important we actually talk about photo security, more so than time itself. And then after the adoption this document, then this report will be sent to all the participants with a directory of the participants, meaning that the addresses, the numbers of the participants will be there. So that after networking and after interacting, and if people want to ask further questions from people that are here, then they can do so. And thirdly, we intend to send it to tertiary institutions for their knowledge, for their information, if they want to read what the different stakeholders are saying about different things. At least they have the information in front of them. It's just for developing the knowledge infrastructure in our country, because we have in Parliament we have a particular knowledge, entrepreneurs have a specific knowledge, and then the different stakeholders have specialized specific knowledge as well. In our nook and cranny, we have that type of knowledge, which then we are sharing not for ourselves but for everybody in the tourism industry. So let me then thank the departments that have participated here, particularly the Department of Tourism that has been with us right through, the Department of Local Government, the Cooperative, and then the other departments, the Department of Art and Culture. Remember, this is a tourism and heritage fund. The Department of Art and Culture are custodians of heritage in South Africa. So, and the Department of Transport, the Department of International Relations, the departments that were here. We did not have the Department of Home Affairs, who are responsible for visas, but I think we shall be in a position to negotiate or interact with them should a need arise. And lastly, and in concluding, let me thank you for your invaluable input. We improved partnerships in between departments. We improved partnerships between the different stakeholders in the industry, and in doing so, our oversight has been enhanced. We have had opportunities for networking. We agree that we shall put more effort into the short left, that is domestic tourism, travel, and
domestic tourism will put our energy to travel, particularly air travel, with the different strategy, particularly around cost, and then frequency, and hubs, and then around transformation. Our partnership has developed, our networking has developed, and the partnership and networking are for a better future, for the future belongs to us all. I wish you all the best. Thank you.